somebody does need to be in charge. Somebody needs to make all of the tough decisions. Someone needs to make sure not to put up with any BS from anyone back there in the locker room. And someone needs to make sure that each and every week, this is the best professional wrestling company on the planet. And I know exactly who that person needs to be. It's not me.
The Salamonster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Ding dong. Dixie is done. Out of power at TNA at long last. I'll cover that later in the show. And also, people talking about maybe the greatest pro wrestling match of all time. That is what some people are saying about the main event of Wrestle Kingdom this past week. I've got my own thoughts on that. It's another packed show this week. It's also the day after our little mini snowpocalypse outside. So if you should hear the sounds of shoveling in the background, Triple H is hard at work, as I will be when I'm done recording here. But first, I want to thank everybody who took the time to nominate the Sound Off for the 2017 Wrestling Radio Awards. I am happy to announce that we have made the final ballot. We are nominated in not one, not two, but four different categories. Show of the Year, Male Interview of the Year from my interview with Bob Holly, Female Interview of the Year from my interview with Katrina from Lucha Underground, the lovely Carly Perez, and Media Interview of the Year for my interview, one of them at least, I did two, with Diamond Dallas Page, who also was in the news this week. So now the tough part begins. The actual voting is now underway, and we need your help to win, because without your support, we can't do it. A lot of tough competition this year, a lot of great shows. You may vote once a day per category, every day through next Thursday. January 19th, that is the deadline. WrestlingRadioAwards.com is the place to go. You can get your friends to vote. You'll see the free ballot right there on the front page. They have a thing going where you can like pay and get like extra votes or something. Don't worry about any of that. There's a free ballot. Everybody can vote. It's right there on the main page. Just scroll down. You'll see the drop-down bars for each category. You can vote for Salamonster Sounds Off under Show of the Year. And again, we have three different interviews nominated in each of the other categories, so you can vote for those as well. And then when you're done, you can tweet your screenshot. You can tweet your submitted ballot to me, at Salamonster on Twitter. You can also tweet them to Bob. You can tweet them to Dallas and Carly and let them know that you voted. Just judging by the response that we've gotten to our Royal Rumble pool in the Facebook group, I mean, my God, if we can channel even part of that, I think we'll do okay here. Audible still offering listeners of the Sound Off here in the new year a 30-day trial of the Audible service and a free audiobook. So if you have not yet cashed in on the death of WCW, what are you waiting for? Audibletrial.com/Salamonster. You got to go through the sign-up process. They will not bill you unless you like the service so much you want to extend beyond the initial 30 days. But even if you cancel within that first month, you get to keep your one free audio book. You can pick whatever book you like, including The Death of WCW, if that's what you want. So use our link, audibletrial.com/Salamonster. And also, you can become a PayPal VIP if you like what you hear every single week. You are free to make a voluntary donation via PayPal. Go to thesalamonster.com. Thesalamonster.com, you'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on the show. You guys keep this thing going. I want to say thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Hot Stuff Hector Pena, The Dark Serpent Derek Gibbs, Canadian Destroyer Rob Morrow, the Marietta Mauler Alexandru Mata, Nemesis Nathan Moyers, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Montreal Mauler Patrick Pacheco, Mass Grave Micah Harshaw, Raymond the Mountie Medina, the Silencer Spencer Dunnings, the Texas All-Star Vinny Minetti, the Westlake Wildman St. Clair Isuka, who runs a YouTube channel by the same name. You can check it out at St. Clair Isuka is the username. That's S-A-I-N-T-C-L-A-I-R-E. And then Isuka is I-S-U-K-A. Check it out. Also, megastar Matt Converse. Now, Matt runs an Amazon web store, and he is offering listeners of the show 10% off any purchase on there when you use the code RUMBLE92. I love it. RUMBLE92. Just go to the website gotobogo.com. That's gotobogo.com. And again, RUMBLE92 is the code to use at checkout. I was browsing it before. He's got a ton of video games, like PS4 games and stuff up there. So if that's your thing, definitely take advantage of that discount. Shout out to Antonio, whose cousin Cody passed away on New Year's Day. I was very sorry to hear that. And I also want to give a shout out to two of our youngest fans, Brandon and Jordan, out in Chino Hills, California. Their dad says they never miss a show. Two fine young men. Two young bucks, I guess you might say. I mentioned the Rumble Pool before. Let me give a quick update on this. We have our fourth annual Royal Rumble Pool ongoing currently in our private group on Facebook. Last week I mentioned that we had already shattered last year's record, which was just under 700 participants. That's a lot of people to participate in a Royal Rumble Pool. Last weekend we had well over 800. So again, we were already well beyond the record from last year. And I said, you know, we had a pretty good shot, I thought, of breaking 1,000. 900 was a given. I really wanted to break 1,000. Well, it took less than 24 hours after I said that and this podcast went up to break 1,000. And in fact, at last count, we had well over 1,300 participants and counting. 1,375 to be exact, which is only like 5 people away from double what we did last year. And last year, we set a record. We jumped from about 690 last year to 1,375 so far. And that's still with 2 weeks left. You guys have about 2 weeks or so left to enter. It's not too late. Saturday, January 21st, which is about a week before the Rumble, Zach Holker, who's helping to run the entire thing, shout out to Zach, on the 21st, he's going to post everybody's random numbers in the Facebook group. I imagine it'll be a separate post. But that's when he's going to post everyone's numbers, so you will want to try to get in before the 21st, unless people can still join out. I mean, I would think that you probably could still join even a few days after that. Zach can clarify that for me. I would imagine we can just add more pools if we have to. I mean, we're already up over 40 pools in this thing. So it's insane. I don't know how he's going to manage it, but, you know, Zach is awesome. I'm sure he'll do fine. But the response has been overwhelming. If you are in the group already, all you need to do is like the pinned post on top that Zach put together. There's no need to leave a comment. Just hit the like button on the post. If you are not in the group, you must find it and apply to become a member. Shoot me a message after you do so, so I know you're a real person and you're not a spam account or a bot or something like that, and I'll get you in there. So I must have spent... I'm not even joking. I must have spent almost, if not half of my week, doing nothing but going through member requests and approving people one by one. We're almost coming very close to 5,000 members in the group. I'm actually coming close to 5,000 friends on Facebook, and I'm pretty sure that's the limit. So once I hit that, I don't think I'm going to be allowed to, I don't think they're going to allow me to add any more friends at that point, but we can add as many as we want to the group, so find it, go there, and apply, and be part of the Rumble Pool. Last Sunday was my annual prediction show for 2017, and already I look to be 2-1 in my predictions, which didn't take very long. I predicted that WWE would bring WrestleMania 34 next year to Minneapolis, to the brand new US Bank Stadium over there, which supposedly is a very nice stadium. Later that same day, when that podcast went up and I predicted that, we learned that WrestleMania 34 is not coming to Minneapolis. It is instead headed back to the Superdome in New Orleans. And that is Superdome, Hogan, not Silverdome. So I screwed the pooch on that one, but I could not be happier. I really could not be happier to be wrong. I had the time of my life in New Orleans for WrestleMania 30. I'm just shocked they're going back there so soon after that last show. I mean, that's a turnaround of about, what, 4 years? You know, they haven't turned a Mania back around to a city like that since Anaheim, WrestleMania 12 and WrestleMania 16. And no offense to the people of the city of Anaheim, but I'm sure Anaheim ain't as fun as New Orleans. New Orleans has apparently been very aggressive at bringing big events to the city. I had such a good time there, and legit, one of the two best vacations I've ever had in my entire life. And now I have a perfect excuse to go back. And not for nothing, one of the best WrestleManias of the last decade, I thought that show was, WrestleMania 30. WrestleMania 30 and 31, I thought overall were very good, but I would go with 30 over 31. It does look like I nailed two other predictions, though. Some people might regard this next one as a spoiler, so if you are sensitive to that kind of stuff and any Hall of Fame announcements, just skip ahead by a few minutes if you don't want to be spoiled. This one is not official yet. WWE has not made any announcements, but PW Insider reported that Diamond Dallas Page is going into the WWE Hall of Fame this year. WWE is also releasing a DVD for DDP. DVD for DDP. I just like saying that. I believe in March is when the DVD is coming out. So if that's the case, it all kind of makes sense. It all kind of ties together. I've had the chance to talk to Dallas many times now, and if this is true, I could not be happier for him. He is somebody who I think absolutely deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. You could put him in the Hall of Fame just for stuff he's done since he's retired from the ring. Not, you know, just stuff he did in WCW. Here's a guy, he didn't even start wrestling until he was, what, 35, I think? 35 years old? And he goes on to become World Heavyweight Champion in a company that at the time was full of big-name stars back then. Hogan and Luger and Sting and Savage and Goldberg. You know, you could have just had the usual rotation of guys. And he ended up becoming, I think, a three-time champion. He was pretty prominently featured there for a while. And I've always said, you know, here's a guy who got himself over. Goldberg and DDP were the only two real big stars you can credit, in my opinion, to WCW having made during the Monday Night War period. Because Sting got over huge. I mean, when Crow Sting first hit the scene and the stuff with Hogan and the build-up to Starrcade, not so much the match, that was huge. But Sting was already a star. Sting, you know, Flair made Sting a star a decade before. I'm talking about guys that were made during that period. Goldberg and DDP are the only real two that come to mind. And DDP worked his ass off and the whole diamond cutter thing, and he got it over, and I think that's a credit to him. I think his feud with Randy Savage is really what put him on the map, and those two had some pretty incredible matches together. In fact, I would say that was the last truly great feud of Savage's career. Obviously, what he's done since getting out of wrestling, DDP Yoga, that's just incredible all by itself. I mean, here's a guy who's built himself, I mean, literally a multi-million dollar business. And, you know, he's helping people, he's saving lives. Jake Roberts and Scott Hall, I think, are proof of that. With any luck, he can add Vader to that list. In fact, Vader posted a tweet yesterday. He just finished the first week of DDP Yoga. He's already down 10 pounds. And he says his diabetes levels are back to normal, which is awesome. That's great to hear. Speaking of the Hall of Fame, PW Insider also reported that Ravishing Rick Rude will be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame this year at long last. I think we can all agree that one is long overdue. Had success in both WWE and I think even more so in WCW. I mean, in WCW, he basically had the world title for a while. And there was a whole, that was during that confusing period where Flair left and they had a different world title, and then Flair came back and they had the international title. But Rude had that top title. I mean, he was on top there for a while. He had some pretty great matches with Ricky Steamboat and Sting and other guys. Also, one of the few men to ever pin the Ultimate Warrior's shoulders to the mat in a match. I can only think of a handful of guys who ever did that in the Warrior's career. I mean, Rude is one of them, Slaughter. Andre did it, you know, clean in a match in Italy that aired on TV over there. So yeah, never aired in this country. But that may legit be, and I don't know what, you know, when he was Dingo Warrior down in Texas, I'm talking about like Ultimate Warrior since leaving Texas. I think that match with Andre is probably the only time he ever, got pinned cleanly in a match. Hogan did in WCW. He pinned him also. I'm pretty sure that's it. And, actually one of my favorite Warrior matches was the one that he had with Rude at SummerSlam 89. I mean, Rude busted his ass in those matches. He bumped around like a madman. He suffered the back injury that ended his career. He suffered that back injury in WCW in a match with Sting in Japan. Might have actually been at the Tokyo Dome. He disappeared for a few years. He came back as the bodyguard for DX for a few months. And then, he made history very infamously by appearing the only man to ever appear on Raw and Nitro simultaneously in the same night. He was on one show with a beard. He was on the other show clean shaven. So the man was a magician. Very impressive. He was training for a comeback when he died. I know that he and Kurt Hennig were best friends. I mean, they knew each other going back to high school. It's a shame that they're both gone. I think Hennig would have been the one to induct him. I'm almost sure of it. And I'm not sure who they get to do it. I know that Rude's son, he might have two sons. I think the older one was killed in a motorcycle accident last year. He's only 19, which is very sad. So, but I'm very happy to hear that he's going in. It's just one of those names. You know, it's a shame he's not going to be there to actually give a speech and be part of the induction. That's what I kind of worry about with a lot of these guys. Like, I'm sure for them, the Hall of Fame is a really nice thing. And, you know, to them, yeah, it's some more than others. It means something. Some guys really don't seem to care. Other guys, it's probably more of a marketing thing where they can go and take bookings on the indies and say, you know, WWE Hall of Famer. Maybe they could ask for more money. You know, I'm sure everybody has their own opinion of the Hall of Fame. But I look at it, and there are guys who are still around now, whereas there are plenty who aren't. But you got guys, I look at Demolition, and I know they're part of that whole concussion suit now against WWE, so they're probably not on the best of terms, but I look at guys like that and I say, these guys aren't getting any younger. These guys are in their 60s, they're getting older. I want these guys to be around. If they're going to go into the Hall of Fame, it would be cool just to kind of see them as a one-off and hear them come out to the music and just have them be part of that moment. And, you know, so guys like Rude who aren't around anymore, it's a shame. And Randy Savage, I'll never forgive, you know, Vince McMahon for that one. But I want to see some of these other, you know, people from that era get the chance to go in while they're still around and they can be part of it and they can enjoy it and put some of these grudges and these things aside. Anyway, the other prediction I got right, and I kind of wish I hadn't, and this one admittedly was not overly difficult to predict. What was surprising, though, was how I included it in my predictions a week ago for 2017, and then it was only, like, literally 2 or 3 days later. It took 2 or 3 days, and this news breaks that the judge in the Jimmy Snuka case did, in fact, dismiss the charges of third-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter against him, dismissed in the death of his mistress, Nancy Argentino. His doctor had given him, you know, 6 months to live. He said his health is rapidly deteriorating. They declared him mentally incompetent to stand trial. And, yeah, I read the news story. The DA's office is looking at what other options may be available to them and what they could do. There's nothing they can do. It's over. It's over. And it's a damn shame. You know, I feel bad for the family that they never got the closure that they had hoped for. They never saw a dime. They won like $500,000 civil judgment against him. They never saw a dime of that money. And he never spent a day behind bars, which he absolutely should have. There was hope. I mean, the way this all came about, again, this is a 33, 34-year-old case. And when the autopsy report, which had been hidden for decades, nobody had seen it, or very few people had seen it. And when that autopsy report finally surfaced, which is only, in the last couple of years, it showed, you know, Nancy had suffered abuse that was consistent with an extended period of abuse. Not Snuka's bullshit story. Oh, well, she fell and she hit her head, and that's really all that happened. It was just a total accident. I mean, whatever happened that night may well have been a quote-unquote accident, but it showed that there was this pattern, this history of abuse going on here, and there was another time, and I've talked about this before, where the cops were called to a hotel. Snuka lost his mind. It took like 10 police officers or police dogs to subdue. I mean, the guy was a madman. The guy was an absolute madman. But that whole thing and the surfacing of the autopsy is what brought this whole story back to life. But the end result is still the same. Snuka will go down. Snuka will go down to me as one of the biggest fuck-ups in wrestling history. For as big of a star as he was back then, and people probably don't really comprehend how big of a star and how popular he really was in that early 80s period. Okay, before, you know, his downfall with this and the drugs and whatever else was going on at the time. He's a big star. One of the biggest. And he fucked it all up because of drugs. He may well have been WWE champion one day, were it not for how out of control and how unreliable he was because of all of that shit that he was involved in. Then you add in the whole thing with Nancy, and it cast a shadow over the rest of this guy's career. Obviously, not enough of one to stop WWE from bringing the guy back in the late 80s. Or for that WrestleMania match with Chris Jericho. Remember the whole Mickey Rourke thing? Yeah, I mean, Snuka was part of that match. It was Jericho against Piper, Steamboat, and Snuka. So he's been brought back plenty of times. And, oh, Jimmy Snuka, and Mick Foley talks about him all the time. And, you know, I know Snuka, he traveled to the Garden. He saw Snuka dive off the cage and all that bullshit. Okay, fine. But as big as he was, as big of a star as he was, he could have been even bigger. And he fucked it all up. And unfortunately, somebody had to lose their life because of this lunatic. Alberto the Ninja Turtle Killer was back in the news this past week. This guy puts on more fights than UFC does. Remember when I rattled off that list of altercations that he's been involved in? Again, this was only a few weeks ago, and I made the comment. I said, this guy is a menace. Well, he struck again. He was arrested the Friday before New Year's in Austria, of all places. So no matter where you are in the world, you're not safe. No place on earth is safe from this man. He was there with his brother Guillermo, who also wrestles. They were there for an indie show. They got into a fight at a nightclub with some dude. They beat him up to the point where the guy had to be taken to the hospital. And so he and his brother were taken to the police station for questioning. At which point, he got into a fist fight at the police station, no less, with his brother. His own brother is not safe from the mayhem. And it was bad enough, and this, I was reading the article, and this read like something out of a movie. I couldn't believe this. They're talking about how they got into a fight at the police station, and it was bad enough that they splattered blood all over the walls of the precinct. And they broke furniture. And when they tried to subdue Alberto using zip ties, he broke free and they had to shackle his ankles. So they were both arrested. They were charged with assault and property damage. And then they were released on bond. And they quickly got out of the country. I guess the charges have been forwarded to the local authorities in Mexico or wherever they live. It's like, holy shit, you can't make this stuff up. Blood splattered all over the walls. It's like, he beats up a Ninja Turtle, he fights his brother in a police station, blood-splattered walls. I mean, what's he going to do next? Is he going to beat up a Make-A-Wish kid for staring at Paige's ass? Would any of us be surprised at this point if we heard that he actually beat up a Make-A-Wish kid for staring at Paige's ass? Because I wouldn't be. I wouldn't be surprised at all. All right, let's talk about Wrestle Kingdom. That was the big story of the week. I think it's safe to say we've already got pay-per-view of the year honors locked up for 2017. If not, then this is going to be a hell of a year. So it's really, if you think about it, I mean, this show is on January 4th, okay? 4 days into the new year, every single year. And this will probably end up being, I don't know, the third or fourth year in a row that it locks up, you know, pay-per-view or show of the year honors. It's not even fair. I saw most of the show, not the entire show. I basically saw everything from the Cody Rhodes match onward. So I missed the Young Bucks match with Roppongi Vice. According to Steve Corino, who was doing the English color commentary for the show, New Japan World, which is their version of the WWE Network and does not have that many subscribers, New Japan World picked up 10,000 new ones on the day of the show, more than half of which came from the United States. So we'll start from the Cody Rhodes match. I just have some thoughts on each of the matches kind of going up to the main event. Cody took on Juice Robinson. Now, Juice Robinson is the former CJ Parker from NXT, the guy who used to bring the sign down to the ring. He was the big, he was the Earth guy, whatever. I mean, who would have thought that one day there'd be a match on the Wrestle Kingdom card between Cody Rhodes and CJ Parker? But here it is. I thought the match was okay, but I bring it up because of an interesting stat that somebody sent me on Cody Rhodes. I believe they said it came from Reddit, so I just want to make sure I'm giving proper credit here. But they emailed this to me, and I thought it was impressive, and I wanted to share it here. With his appearance on this show, Cody Rhodes becomes the first, and I'm guessing probably the only man ever, to appear at WrestleMania, PWG's Battle of Los Angeles, which has turned into a kind of a big deal every year, TNA Bound for Glory, Ring of Honor Final Battle, and Wrestle Kingdom, all in the span of 1 year. How about that? He competed in the Intercontinental title match at WrestleMania last year. He wrestled Sami Callihan and Marty Scurll at Bola. He didn't wrestle, but he debuted for TNA at Bound for Glory, and I think he laid out Mike Bennett. He wrestled Jay Lethal at Final Battle, and he beat Juice Robinson here at Wrestle Kingdom. So if there was a Guinness Book of Wrestling Records, he would be in there right now. The only thing missing from that list is Ultima Lucha. And there's still time if he can pull it off by April. April, it'll be 1 year since the WrestleMania match. Kyle O'Reilly and Adam Cole had a match for the Ring of Honor title. I think this was the second or third time that the ROH title has been defended on the Wrestle Kingdom card. Adam Cole becomes the first ever three-time Ring of Honor champion in the history of the promotion. Last year, it was AJ Styles and Shinsuke Nakamura wrestling at Wrestle Kingdom. And then right after, both guys ended up going to WWE. This match could turn out the same way. We're not sure. It's still early. A lot can happen. But Kyle O'Reilly turned down an offer from Ring of Honor to re-sign before this show, according to Ryan Satin. So he is now working for Ring of Honor on a per-appearance deal. He has no binding contract with them. He is free to negotiate or go and sign with whoever, work wherever he wants to. There's a lot of rumors about him going to NXT. I don't know what way he's leaning. I know his partner Bobby Fish, Red Dragon, Bobby Fish apparently was offered a deal by WWE. He turned it down. He's re-signed or is going to re-sign with Ring of Honor. I don't know if that might influence Kyle O'Reilly's decision. Kyle O'Reilly is a really talented guy. Does NXT need him? No, I don't think NXT does. I don't think it changes the face of NXT or anything. I mean, he'd be a talented guy for them to have. I don't have this overwhelming sense of, I hope he signs with NXT. If he does, great. If not, to me, it would mean more for him to stay with Ring of Honor than it would for him to come over to WWE. And then as far as Adam Cole is concerned, the belief is that Adam Cole is going to go to WWE when his deal is up in a few months. We'll see what happens. Obviously, if they do, they're going to have to get the title off of him. Who they put it on, I don't know. Jay Lethal just re-signed with Ring of Honor for 2 years. They could put it back on him. If they wanted to go that route, I'm not quite sure who they would go with. Or maybe Cole decides, you know what, I like this gig that I've got now. I can go to Japan and I can work ROH. But he's a guy who I think would thrive in WWE and I think could be a real big star there. Top three matches on this card were as good as any top three on any pay-per-view that I've ever seen. Actually, to be honest with you, I might rate the top three from last year's show a little bit higher, last year's Wrestle Kingdom card, but it's close. It's close. It's a rat race between those two. Because last year, if you remember, you had Shibata and Ishii, which was a lot of fun to watch. You had AJ and Nakamura, which was just an incredible match. And you had Tanahashi and Okada, and what it was the culmination of a years-long story between Tanahashi and Okada, where Okada could not beat this fucker at the Tokyo Dome. They had a whole bunch of matches, and finally, Okada got the big win. So, that top three from last year, I think, is really hard to beat. But I would say this was up there with it. You had Goto and Shibata. I loved. What I loved even more about it was the commentary of Kevin Kelly and Steve Corino. I usually will listen to the Japanese announcers when I watch any New Japan. Even though I have, like last year's show, I listened to the Japanese commentary. I mean, thank God there was no Yoshitatsu this year. What a disaster that was last year. But I usually listen to the Japanese announcers, even though I have no idea what they're saying. I don't have to, because their enthusiasm is so, it's like it's so infectious that it just more than makes up for whatever I'm not actually understanding. But I listen to the English commentary because I know Carino's on his way out. He's going to WWE. Boy, you seem to be hearing that a lot when it comes to Ring of Honor lately. But Carino's going there to be a trainer. He's on his way out. I've always liked him and Kevin Kelly as a team. So I wanted the chance to hear them together one last time. I mean, I guess they did the commentary for the New Year's Dash show the next day. I haven't watched that. But for me, this is probably the last time I'm going to hear these two on commentary together. So I went with the English commentary, and they were telling the backstory during the match between Shibata and Goto and how they've known each other going back to when they were in high school together and how Shibata does not like Goto. And the reason he doesn't like him, the problem he has with him, is how he takes losing. Shibata hates to lose. If he loses a match, it consumes him. It infuriates him. It bothers him until he avenges that loss. It's the worst thing that could possibly happen to this guy is to lose a match. Whereas Goto takes a more laid-back approach to losing. If he loses, it's almost like, all right, no big deal. There'll be another day. I'll just come back and win the next time. And Shibata just doesn't understand this. He can't comprehend this. He cannot accept this. Shibata would hate John Cena. And actually, now that I say that, I kind of want to see Shibata go up against John Cena. So anyway, I really just like the way the announcers explain things. It really just added to the backstory of the match. And of course, the match itself kicked ass. I mean, these guys beat the piss out of each other and Goto won. Tanahashi and Naito, I thought, had a great match. You talk about psychology and working body parts and stuff. They did it. It wasn't like done in a boring way or anything. It made sense. They were going back and forth, but they kept going after each other's knee. They each worked over the other's knee. That played into most of the match, really. Naito wins. That surprised me. I saw Tanahashi winning. I admit I have not been following the week-to-week, month-to-month of everything that's been going on lately in New Japan, so maybe that should not have come as a surprise. I don't know. I do know, like, even here, though, the story being told was Tanahashi now going back to last year and the loss to Okada at the Tokyo Dome has run up a string of big losses. And now here's another one. And so the question is this the end? Is this it? Has he reached the end of his rope? Is this the end of the ace? They call him the ace of New Japan. Is this it for him? Can he win another big match? WWE is doing a similar story right now with John Cena. Very similar story. And then we have the main event. A match that many people are calling the greatest match they've ever seen. The greatest match, maybe, in the history of professional wrestling. Dave Meltzer gave it 6 snowflakes in his newsletter. Ricochet called it the best match he's ever seen. Rocky Romero said it may have been the best match he's ever seen. It even got praise from a whole bunch of WWE people on Twitter. Tyson Kidd and Natalya, Daniel Bryan chimed in. Everybody was talking about this match, and rightfully so. The match was incredible. Absolutely incredible match. That said, it wasn't even the best New Japan match I've ever seen. I thought Nakamura and Kota Ibushi a couple of years ago at Wrestle Kingdom was better. And I thought Okada and AJ Styles from that Dominion show in 2015 was also better. Now, this match was longer. This thing went over 45 minutes. But longer doesn't always mean better. But, I mean, how many stars does it get, and is it half a star better than the... Like, who really cares? You know what I mean? Like, it was a great match. It was a great fucking match. Just not the greatest since, Gotch and Hackenschmidt. I can't go that far. I can't say that. It's a great match, though. Started slow. It built from there. I thought that table spot was absolutely insane. One of the most dangerous bumps I've seen in a long-ass time. Okada backdropped this guy so high out of that ring. You know, it's ironic. I talked about Rick Rude earlier, okay, given how his career came to an end. In Japan, no less, on a similar bump involving that raised platform that they use. They had a slightly raised platform on this show, too, where the ring and the surrounding mats outside are raised up however many inches from the ground. I guess it's supposed to help with sight lines for the people in the Tokyo Dome. I don't know. I think it's just too dangerous. But, you know, here, Okada was flying blind when he backdropped Omega out of that ring. And Omega was literally flying blind through the air. And go back and watch where he landed. If he overshoots that table, now he hit the table, not perfectly, but he hit the table and the table kind of disintegrated upon impact. And then he kind of landed and fell off the platform. But go back and watch where Omega landed, okay? If he overshoots that table by just a couple of inches, there's a pretty good chance he probably suffers the exact same kind of injury that Rick Rude did. That could have been the end of Kenny Omega's career. All this talk about, oh, Kenny Omega, he's the best thing since sliced bread. That could have been it for him. So that was scary. That was scary stuff. And scary is a good word for some of those bumps that Okada took on the back of his neck. It's like, Jesus. Carino made a great comment, if you were listening to the English commentary. It was after Okada took that sick suplex. I don't know if it was an exploder or what it was. From the top rope, and they showed the replay, and he landed right on his neck. And Carino just says, you know, he's going to remember that when, not if, when he has neck fusion surgery. And Carino would know because he just had that same surgery not too long ago. I like the fact that Kenny Omega teased using the one-winged angel a whole bunch of times, never actually hit the move. He never actually connected and hit the finish. I'm sure that will play into their next match. And believe me, there will be a next match. Kenny Omega will win the championship with that one-winged angel, and it's going to be huge when he finally hits that thing, and it's not going to take three or four of them to beat Okada either, like Okada did with all those Rainmakers. Okay, Okada must have hit him with about four or five different Rainmakers, finally got the win. It ain't going to take that many for Kenny Omega to beat him and win the title next time. That's the story that is going to be told. And when it was over, these two guys looked like they had been in a war. Okada, I saw, made a comment about how there was a point in the match where he felt like he was literally going to die. I'm not sure how or even if these two can top what they did here the next time they meet, but I'm sure they're going to try. That may not be good for their health, but I'm sure it'll be good for everybody watching. I expect Omega to be the IWGP champion before the summer is over. And, you know, he made news this week even after the match. He posted some cryptic tweets about stepping away from Japan to reassess my future. He says, my schedule is cleared. I'm weighing all of my options. It's an interesting thing for him to say, considering he just did an interview with Sports Illustrated, where he talked about not wanting to be just another cog in the wheel and how I would rather be remembered as, almost like the modern day Sting, I would rather be remembered as the guy who never stepped foot in a WWE ring, even though he was part of developmental there and everything. But I want to be that guy that, you know, never steps foot in a WWE ring. And he really was shooting hard on some of the guys in WWE without naming names who, you know, seem to enjoy just skating by in the background and coming to work and getting a paycheck and having that cachet of, hey, I'm a WWE superstar, but not really being used to their full potential. They have a job, they're comfortable, and they're just happy kind of skating on by. He was talking a lot about that, and guys are just happy to have a job there. And how he called it the worst shit ever, I believe were his exact words. So it's a pretty good interview. You should go back and check it, but I don't actually expect him to go to WWE. I don't think that's what this is about. Or NXT. I mean, frankly, I don't think he should. Like, let's say that he is stepping away from Japan and he actually is considering taking some kind of an offer from WWE. And I don't think that's the case. But let's say it's true. I think that would be a mistake. I really do. I mean, you can make the argument, well, his stock has never been higher. Now is the time. Strike while the iron's hot. I mean, there is something to be said for that. But I just think it would be a big mistake for him to make that jump right now. Now, I fully expect him to down the road. I mean, this talk about, I'm never going to set foot in a WWE ring is complete bullshit. Of course he will. Everybody says that, and in the end, they all go to WWE because they take the money and because they want to, you know, they get tired of doing the same thing wherever they are. I'm telling you, if it's a year, if it's 2 years, Kenny Omega will be in WWE. Mark my words. So, but, you know, he could talk about that and that sounds all great and it makes him this big, you know, hero to a lot of people. But believe me, he'll go down the same road that eventually everybody else goes down. The thing is, though, WWE right now is in full acquisition mode, right? They're grabbing guys left and right. They're spitting out contracts like they're nothing. They're signing guys, these guys in the UK, they're locking everybody into these deals so that the bigger promotions can't put any of them on TV, right? It sounds nice. Well, we're signing these guys and we're going to let them work their like native promotion wherever they are in the UK. Like that's all well and good. But again, they're signing these guys to basically take them away from the bigger players and to have them all for themselves. And at some point, if they suddenly take an interest in somebody, maybe they'll actually bring them stateside and they'll do something with them, and maybe they won't. But they're in full acquisition mode right now. So, of course, if Kenny Omega were interested or if Kenny Omega were available, they would take him in a heartbeat. Of course they would. But Kenny Omega is going to be the IWGP champion. He's going to be in the role that AJ Styles was in 2 years ago. And I think that paid off pretty handsomely for AJ Styles. Because he didn't go right to WWE from TNA. It wasn't the TNA stuff that he did that most people were talking about. It was this great run that he had for himself as a top guy in New Japan Pro Wrestling, which had a lot more buzz around it than TNA did. And he was the leader of the Bullet Club. The Bullet Club, one of the most popular, you know, factions anywhere in the world. You see Bullet Club shirts and merch all over the place. So, you know, that worked out pretty well for AJ Styles. But he went to Japan first, and he made believers probably out of some people in WWE who were not believers before. Because if WWE was so interested in AJ Styles, they would have grabbed him before he ever had the chance to go over and have that big run in New Japan. And apparently, initially, they either made no offer, or there were stories that they lowballed him on an offer, they made him some kind of an offer that was insulting, so he didn't go. And a year later, it was a complete 180. They brought this guy in, now he's the champion, he's the MVP in that company, he's one of the top stars in the entire world. So Kenny Omega has a brand to build, okay? This guy may be the hottest thing in wrestling after that match with Okada. All anybody's been talking about this whole week is Kenny Omega. People hate him, people love him, he's the best, he's the worst. But they've been talking about this guy now for almost a full week. And he's got a lot of buzz around him, and he needs to build on that. He needs to make that even bigger. And believe me, in a year, WWE will want this guy even more than they probably do right now. And the offer, if they make him one, will probably be even sweeter. So I think it's either a case of him just trolling people, and he's going to be back in a month or two and attack Okada. Or maybe he just legit wants to take a few months off and heal up if he's hurting. I mean, this guy's been going nonstop for a while now. He had an incredible 2016. He's been killing it in the ring. He's been beating his body to shit, I'm sure, having these matches. So maybe he legitimately just needs a few months off to heal up, and then he'll come back stronger than ever. But no, I don't think he's going to WWE anytime soon. Monday Night Raw last week was live from Tampa, Florida. Raw Twitter poll, over 2,200 votes. 31% thumbs up, 69% thumbs down. Thank you to Keelan Bain for showing some love for the Sound Off in Tampa. In the opening shot of the very first Raw of the new year, holding up his Solo Monster Sound Off sign. That was very cool. Easy way to get yourself a shout out on this podcast, by the way, is to get your Sound Off sign on TV. Cheap pop. Raw was back on top in the ratings this week. Could probably thank Goldberg for that. I'm going to talk about him in a little bit. They actually booked. I want to go through some of the things on this show that took place last Monday. They actually booked a Seth Rollins, Kevin Owens match to open the show, which I know is something we've never seen before. And the loser, this is the stipulation, the loser would be barred from ringside in the U.S. title match later in the show between Roman Reigns and Chris Jericho. Now, I could talk about how ridiculous this is to have your top champion, the Universal Champion, in the opening match on the show with a stip that ties into the U.S. title main event and how, you know, Roman Reigns is still the top guy, but we've already known that. We know Roman Reigns, U.S. title or not, Universal title or not, he's their top guy. It's just the way it is. But that's not even what bothered me. What bothers me is the fact that they booked a match to open the show involving their Universal Champion, where the stipulation essentially was basically to decide who gets to interfere in the main event. That's essentially what the stipulation was. Now, I know Seth Rollins, who won, did not actually interfere. So it was more to keep Kevin Owens away than anything else. But that basically was the stipulation here. The loser of this match is barred, and the winner couldn't, I guess, come down and do whatever the fuck they want. That was the stipulation for the opening match on this show. This is what the creative on this show has come to. This is what it's come to. And it gets worse. But I'm going to save that rant for the end of this review. I don't want to get into that just yet. That's coming up later. Like I said, Rollins won. He ended up not interfering in the main event. I am not really sure what the point of all this was. I guess it was just to get Owens away from being at ringside for the main event, which they could have done, you know, with a simple two-minute backstage segment. Anyway, Braun Strowman. Actually, before I even get to Braun Strowman, I got to just mention this. Carl Anderson. Carl Anderson, who has been just a dead duck in this company in the last 6 months. I mean, he and Gallows just, I don't even know what to say anymore about them. But even in the tag matches and everything, he's always the one to take the fall. I mean, this guy just can't catch a break. Well, finally, he caught one. Carl Anderson got a rare singles win over Cesaro here on the show. He actually won a match, a singles match, no less. I figured I would have a better chance of not just finding Bigfoot, but finding Bigfoot dabbing in the woods while broadcasting on Periscope before I would ever see the day that Carl Anderson would win a singles match on the show. But there you have it. Braun Strowman had a last man standing match with Sami Zayn, which was the best match on the entire show. They brawled into the backstage area at one point, which I thought was cool. I only wish they would have explored the back even more. Like, I love that kind of stuff. We don't have enough brawls, I think, that spill over, like matches that spill over into the backstage area anymore. I think like Undertaker and Mankind in the Boiler Room brawl, once they got out of the Boiler Room, kind of brawling through the hallways and all the wrestlers are there cheering them on. And, Kevin Sullivan and Chris Benoit at the Great American Bash brawling into the men's bathroom. Al Snow and the Big Boss Man literally fighting out of the arena and into the streets on the sidewalk at SummerSlam 1 year. That was back when they were fighting over the hardcore title. I mean, that's the kind of shit that I'd like to see more of every now and then. Sammy used tons of weapon shots in this match. It was the only chance he had. He had tons of kendo stick shots on Strowman. Strowman had welts all over his body after the show. At one point, he gave Strowman a high cross body off the Raw stage through a bunch of tables down below. So this was hardly a squash. I mean, this was not a squash match. They gave Sammy a lot. He was the underdog trying to fight back. And by the end, unfortunately for him, I'm watching this and even I'm begging. And not even, I'm not talking like character, like in kayfabe. Like, this guy was taking a beating. And I felt sorry for him the way he was being slammed on the floor. And it's like, you know what? Like, if ever there was a time for Mick Foley to come out and throw in the towel, this would be a good time to do it. Like, I felt bad for this guy. He had the crap beaten out of him. He lost. Foley did come out. He brought an EMS crew out with him. They put Zayn on a stretcher. Strowman knocked the stretcher over and knocked him off it. They're doing all the right things with this guy so far. He still looks weird whenever he has to sell. He doesn't look great. He looks like he's, being attacked by a bunch of invisible porcupines. But he's getting over, and that's really the only thing that matters. Roman Reigns retained his U.S. title over Chris Jericho in a match where he could have lost the title by countout or disqualification. They're doing all these things to always make you think that, okay, this is going to be the night, right? Surely if he can drop the title without getting pinned, they're going to take it off him because he's going to get the Universal belt anyway, and they'll put the title on Chris Jericho. But no, they didn't do that here. Roman wins again. Kevin Owens was banished, as I mentioned earlier, from ringside. Jericho loosened one of the turnbuckles. Referee saw it. He went to go fix it. Jericho then grabbed the U.S. belt, pulled an Eddie Guerrero. He tossed the belt to Roman Reigns. Roman was dumb enough to catch it. Jericho dropped to the mat like Roman had just hit him with it, and when the ref turned around, he kind of put two and two together. He was considering disqualifying Reigns, which would have meant we have a new champion. He ended up not doing so, and Jericho ran himself into the turnbuckle that he exposed and got speared and pinned. Rusev and Jinder Mahal beat Big Cass in a handicap match because Enzo was confined to a wheelchair. I don't know why. I've only been half paying attention to the storyline, so I guess Rusev, all the beatings have led to paralysis of the lower body. I don't know why he was in a wheelchair, but there he was. I mention all of this. Why? Because if they didn't do a random wellness check on Jinder Mahal backstage at this show, then they need to soon, because this guy got real ripped real fast. He looks like he's on the same diet Del Rio was on when he first came back. Bayley beat Nia Jax to become number one contender to Charlotte's title at the Royal Rumble. Sasha Banks came out, distracted Nia, which led to her, or Bayley, that is, giving Nia the belly-to-belly off the ropes. Sad tweet of the week, by the way, goes to Sasha Banks, who tweeted, "I miss NXT." She tweeted that on Thursday. Who could blame her? Do you really blame her? Stephanie was, they started something with Stephanie and Bayley on this show. Stephanie was being really mean to Bayley earlier in the night, telling her, "I never wanted you on the show in the first place. It was a Mick Foley decision." And basically she's throwing roadblocks in her way. This is the same storyline I pitched over a year ago, before last year's WrestleMania. I do think Stephanie is perfect for this. There's a lot of reasons why I wish Stephanie McMahon would just disappear from TV. I think she's more of a hindrance than anything else to this show. She has her moments where, you know, she can be out there, her facial expressions, and she can be really good, but she's just, she's an absolute negative blot on the show most weeks. But the one role for her that I think is perfect is as something of a foil to Bayley, because Stephanie is so hateable and Bayley is so likable that I actually think it will help make Bayley that much more of a sympathetic figure. So I actually think that's a good role, one of the few, for Stephanie to be in on this show. Goldberg was back. Kevin Owens and Chris Jericho had him on for their very first installment of the Kevin Owens Show. Jericho also entered himself into the Royal Rumble match, which upset Owens greatly. Jericho argued that, look, if we wrestle at WrestleMania, if I win the Rumble and I go on to WrestleMania, it doesn't matter who wins, we still keep the Universal title. And Owens didn't seem like he was buying that. He wasn't really on board with that idea, which of course not, because he realizes that that means that Jericho won't be there to help him. If the guy's wrestling me, he can't be there to help me. And that's really all he's interested in, because Kevin Owens is not friends with anybody. He doesn't give a shit about Chris Jericho deep down. It's all about Kevin Owens. That's been his character from day one. So it sure does look like my prediction is off, and we're getting Kevin Owens and Chris Jericho at WrestleMania. Probably not for the Universal title. Maybe the U.S. But anyway, Goldberg came out. He and Owens had a stare down, which is honestly something I never thought I would see. Bill Goldberg in 2017 in a WWE ring having a face-off with Kevin Steen. Not something that would have been on my prediction list 5 years ago. Paul Heyman showed up. He trolled everybody into thinking that Brock Lesnar was there, which, of course, he wasn't. It is amazing to me how easy it is to fool these people. They fall for it every single time. He really didn't say much. Roman Reigns came out to a chorus of boos. He had a stare down of his own with Goldberg. Goldberg supposedly signed for 3 pay-per-views with the company when he extended his deal. So not just Royal Rumble and WrestleMania, but supposedly Fastlane in March. He's going to have a match. I'm wondering if it means we're going to get Goldberg. I mean, I've seen a lot of rumors about this. Goldberg and Roman Reigns is rumored. I could see that. I could see a situation where you have Goldberg and Reigns, if Reigns wins the championship, let's say, and Goldberg gets his title match, but he gets it at Fastlane to give Fastlane a big attraction, and Brock interferes and he costs Goldberg the championship, and that's the real impetus for them to have a match at WrestleMania. I mean, I figure they're going to end up eliminating each other in the Rumble match, but yeah, I suppose I could see that. And look, you don't have to like Roman Reigns, but Roman Reigns against Goldberg for the title, even without the title on the line, that's a big match. So they would be smart if they wanted to get, you know, one extra big match out of Goldberg while they have him. But I could very easily see Goldberg against Kevin Owens, whether it's for the title or not. They had their stare down on this show. So I could see them going down that road too against Goldberg against Owens or Jericho. I think it would be one of those three would seem to make the most sense to me, because they're all kind of involved in this, in this story of, going after the championship. I mean, I guess we'll see. Any one of those matches would be a big attraction for the Fastlane card, but I do think Goldberg and Roman Reigns, there is something to that match, the Battle of the Spears, you know, these two big baby faces. I mean, I call Roman Reigns a baby face, I know. But he is. That's how he's booked. He's the babyface that gets booed. That's just how it is. John Cena played that role for years. It's amazing to me to see Roman Reigns has now fully taken over that role. John Cena will still get booed a lot when he comes out, but it's not as bad as it used to be. You can watch that contract signing segment on SmackDown, and there was nothing out of the ordinary. It wasn't like John Cena was being drowned out by boos or anything like that. In fact, he got a lot of cheers because he was really freaking good in that segment. Roman, though, just can't catch a break. I mean, he has now fully immersed himself, whether he likes it or not, in this role as the new age John Cena, who comes out and just gets his ass booed out of the building every single week through no fault of his own. It's nothing that he did, but that's just how it is. So anyway, we'll be seeing more of Goldberg in the ring before WrestleMania. Now, I could see them feeding either one of Owens or Jericho, not so much Roman Reigns, because it would be easy to feed Goldberg a win. That's the other thing about if you do Goldberg against Owens or Goldberg against Jericho, that's an easy win for Goldberg. Because I figure Goldberg is going to Mania, he's putting Brock over. I mean, at some point, Brock's obviously going to get his win back. It's probably going to be at WrestleMania. So if they want to give Goldberg another singles win on that road to Mania, you're not going to do it against Roman Reigns. Goldberg ain't going in there and beating or squashing Roman Reigns. But Goldberg to go in there and beat Jericho or Owens and tie the story in of maybe Owens accidentally cost Jericho the match or Jericho accidentally costs Owens the match. And Goldberg wins, not the title, but he wins. And that right there is the impetus for team Jericho and Owens to finally break up. And it leads to them having a match at WrestleMania. That's why I kind of tend to think that scenario is more likely than the one with Roman. But the match with Roman would be bigger. Braun Strowman came out. The segment was not over. Braun Strowman came out. He said, I'm going to win the Royal Rumble match. And Roman Reigns and Goldberg, they looked at each other. And they ended up laying out Strowman with a double spear. That actually got Reigns cheered, which I'm sure is exactly what this was designed to do. Let's get him out there with Goldberg, who's hot right now. I mean, Goldberg didn't get a really overly fantastic reaction on TV this past week, not like he did months ago. But he's still probably the number one babyface in the entire company right now. And so let's put Roman out there, and it worked. It rubbed off on Roman. The double spear spot was cool. It got big cheers. It did exactly what it was designed to do, I'm sure. On their Instagram, there's been some confusion here. WWE put a photo up with the caption, Roman Reigns, Braun Strowman, and Goldberg will collide in the Royal Rumble match. Could just be a typo. I would not assume that Roman Reigns is going to be in the Royal Rumble match. They have not said that on TV, nor do I think they would, because it wouldn't make any sense. Everybody knows Roman is in the title match, and I think if you tell people he's in the Rumble, you're just tipping your hand that he ain't winning the championship, but he's probably winning the Rumble. So it could very well just be a typo. Some guy on their social media just made a mistake. I don't know if they've since fixed it. It might still be up. Let's not assume that he is in the Rumble. Let's not lose our minds just yet. Let's see if they say anything about it on Monday night. But again, if it turns out that Roman Reigns is going to be in the Royal Rumble match, to me, that's just foreshadowing exactly what's going to happen in the title match and the fact that Roman may just be walking out of the Alamo Dome with I guess that would be his second Royal Rumble win. And I'm sure that would be much to the delight of the people in the Alamo Dome that night. Personally, I would rather not see another Royal Rumble hijacked. I think you keep Roman right where he is. Even if he wins the title, that's fine. He doesn't have to be in the Rumble match.
This is CNN Breaking News.
Wait a minute. I'm being told we have some breaking news here into the Sound Off. Blockbuster news about the main event of tomorrow night's Monday Night Raw. I'm being told that Roman Reigns will defend his United States Championship against, are you ready for this? Both Chris Jericho and Kevin Owens. Finally, a fresh match on Monday Night Raw. Yeah, I just yawned so hard, I think I may have dislocated my jaw. Let me pop it back into place here. Yes, the main event for Raw tomorrow night is a handicap match for the U.S. title. And I'm just wondering, you know, how many combinations of Roman Reigns against Kevin Owens and Chris Jericho can we possibly get? So, yesterday, I mentioned our little mini snowpocalypse here. As I'm sure the people in many other states look at New York and just say, a bunch of pussies. Which is probably true. We got like 5 or 6 inches. But it was a snow day here. Couldn't really go anywhere. Couldn't really do much. So I had some extra time. I decided to go back and track exactly how many matches, TV matches, okay, because I'm not talking about the live events. How many matches have been booked on this show since the brand split involving some combination of Roman Reigns, Chris Jericho, and Kevin Owens? I had to look into this. Because when I heard this breaking news alert from WWE, when they posted it the other day, I just about lost my mind. So I said, I gotta look into this here. The answer? A lot. And this, by the way, I'm gonna read all the matches off to you right now. And this does not even include Seth Rollins. Because if I threw Seth Rollins in there, it's even worse. So here we go. I'm gonna read this list to you. And it goes all the way back to the summer. August 22nd, Roman Reigns versus Chris Jericho. The following week, they had that great fatal four-way where Triple H helped Owens win the Universal title. Jericho was not in that match, but Owens and Reigns were, so I'm counting it. September 12th, Roman Reigns versus Kevin Owens. Twice. The first time Seth Rollins interfered for the DQ, so Mick Foley restarted the match. September 19th, Roman Reigns versus Kevin Owens. Steel cage match. Halloween, October 31st, Chris Jericho against Roman Reigns. November 7th, Roman Reigns, Kevin Owens, Chris Jericho, Seth Rollins, and Braun Strowman in a five-way. A week later, Roman Reigns and Kevin Owens teamed up. A little twist on things. They teamed up against Sheamus and Cesaro. November 28th, Roman Reigns versus Kevin Owens. December 5th, Roman Reigns versus Chris Jericho. December 12th, Roman Reigns teamed with Seth Rollins against Kevin Owens and Chris Jericho and The New Day for the tag team titles. December 18th, Roadblock, End of the Line. Roman Reigns against Kevin Owens for the Universal title. Chris Jericho interferes for the DQ. The very next night, December 19th, Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins team up again to take on Kevin Owens and Chris Jericho. Are you dizzy yet? Because I'm not done. December 26th, Merry fucking Christmas, Roman Reigns versus Kevin Owens. January 2nd, Happy New Year, Roman Reigns versus Chris Jericho. Tomorrow night, January 9th, Roman Reigns against both Kevin Owens and Chris Jericho for the United States Championship. And of course, lest we forget, the Royal Rumble coming up January 29th, Roman Reigns against Kevin Owens for the Universal title with Chris Jericho hanging above the ring in a shark cage. I am sick to death of Roman Reigns, Kevin Owens, and Chris Jericho playing merry-go-round here. Enough. And since neither one of them can apparently beat Roman Reigns, I mean, there might have been a match in there where Owens actually won, but basically, these two are incapable of beating this man. I guess it's the only shot they have to put them in a two-on-one handicap match. We can beat them two-on-one. We're also getting Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker making appearances tomorrow night. Undertaker, nobody seems to know what he's going to be there for. All I can say is this. Undertaker better announce himself for the Royal Rumble match, because if he doesn't, then what the hell was the point of saying WrestleMania will no longer define my legacy? Can you explain that to me? We don't have a whole lot of time between now and WrestleMania. You're either doing something at WrestleMania, which makes you a liar, or you're going to be in the Rumble match. Maybe Undertaker's new gimmick is that he has gone senile and he has lost his mind. One week he's on SmackDown talking about digging holes and you know, fucking souls and whatever it was that he was doing. My legacy is not just WrestleMania. Then he vanishes. Now he's on Raw. He doesn't know what he's doing. His new gimmick is he's senile and he has lost his mind. Jimmy Snuka won't be happy about that one. That's gimmick infringement, brudda. All right, so anyway, that's enough of Raw. Let's talk about this Bring It to the Table show on the network. While I'm all riled up, this is a good time to talk about this, because this is one of the two things that people wanted me to talk about most on the show this week. It was this and Wrestle Kingdom. They brought in Peter Rosenberg from Hot 97 here in New York, also host of Cheap Heat, to host this show. Paul Heyman and JBL were the panelists. Basically, the format, it's a copy of Pardon the Interruption on ESPN. I think the format has promise, but as a first episode, I hated it. I hated it. I was really put off by how flippant they were of the fans' opinions, especially Heyman. I mean, JBL, I thought, actually was fine. He tried to be very respectful and he wasn't, obnoxious or anything like that. But the show, it just seemed like their excuse to take all of the popular criticisms their most hardcore fans have of the product, who, by the way, are the ones actually paying for this. You don't actually think that Joe Schmo, who's a casual wrestling fan, is paying $9.99 a month for this network, do you? Because he's not. It's the hardcores who are paying the $9.99 to watch the network. So these are the people that are paying for the network. They're subscribing to the network. And basically what they're doing here, or at least on this first show, they're taking their opinions and they're just bashing them for it, right? That's what this was. It just seemed like that was the purpose of this show. And it's one thing to debate the merits of what they're complaining about, of what the fans are complaining about, which they did do some of. I'm not saying it was just one big long bash fest, and there was some of that here. JBL, I thought more so. I thought he made some intelligent points. Whether you agree with them or not is a separate issue. But multiple times here on the show, I had to hear the old, if you don't like it, don't watch it, and they'll find anything to bitch about. You know what? Yeah, some people do. Some people do. But that's a hell of an attitude to take with your audience. Yes, lots of people do bitch for the sake of bitching. I'm bitching right now, in fact, okay? Although I'm not doing it just for the sake of it. But lots of people, I think, also have some very valid criticisms. And I didn't think that it was being taken seriously at all. And that's something they have to be more sensitive to, I think, on future episodes. Because if that's all this is going to be every week, we'll have this rotating guest panel of people who just shit on all the fans, then I ain't going to watch this. And after a while, people are going to get tired of it. They're not going to watch it. Now, JBL did make one point about UFC. I have to call him out for this. Just absolutely blew my mind. And maybe this is not the way he intended for it to be phrased, but this is how I took it. He was trying to make a point about why it's smart to have Brock Lesnar in the Royal Rumble match as opposed to having a singles match on that show, which, I think Rosenberg brought that up. Like, I didn't even know that was a criticism. I have no problem with Brock Lesnar being in the Royal Rumble match. And I agree with JBL in that, you can have him in the Rumble match as an attraction and save the singles attraction for a different pay-per-view. I have no problem with that. I think it's cool to have Brock Lesnar in the Rumble. I didn't know that that was something that upset some people. But they were having a conversation or a debate about that. And he used UFC as an example to try to make his point. And JBL said, look, I'm a fan of UFC, but they burn through their top guys at lightning speed because they book every top talent against every top talent at every pay-per-view. Now, UFC does have a lot of pay-per-views. They do have too many pay-per-views. But holy shit, when he said that, my eyes nearly bugged out of my head. Booking the same guys on top against each other over and over. After I just got done running down that list of 5,000 matches that we've seen in the last 5 months involving some combination of Roman Reigns, Chris Jericho, and Kevin Owens. And he, representing WWE on this show, he of all people is going to make the point about another promotion booking the same faces on top against each other. I was blown away by this. That was so rich. That was so rich, he could have crapped out a $1,000 bill. I couldn't believe it. I'm just listening to this and I'm like, are you kidding me right now? Are you really trying to make this point? Because you're not doing a very good job. So they talked about the merits of the brand extension. They talked about whether or not they think Hulk Hogan should come back, which they do. JBL ranted on Bret Hart dissing Michael Hayes and saying the Freebirds don't belong in the Hall of Fame, which is old news by now because Bret has since apologized for making those comments. And to his credit, Rosenberg did mention that. Then they delved into such riveting topics as, did Ric Flair really fuck Halle Berry? And the Bella Twins have a new YouTube channel, which, who gives a shit? The subject that they talked about that I got the most questions about and you guys wanted me to address was the subject of 3-hour Raws. As if I haven't talked about this enough. Is it too much? That was the question posed. Should Raw go back to being 2 hours? The only one who seemed to favor Raw going back to 2 hours was Rosenberg, who represented the voice of the fans on a lot of these issues because that's what he is. He is a fan. JBL, of course, defended the company. He ran down all of the different figures the company makes on their TV contract to justify the extra hour. I think he said the TV deal was for $173 million. About $130 million comes from the network. $100 million from live events and $50 million from the rest of all of their revenue streams. My take is this. Nobody is denying that television is the biggest driver of this company. You look at the money they make off that TV contract. They're a publicly traded company. These numbers are readily available. It's very obvious. And it's also why I laugh whenever people try to argue that, you know, ratings no longer matter. I get emails from time to time. Why do you talk about the ratings? They don't matter anymore. That's a Monday Night War thing. Okay, tell that to the USA Network. Tell that to USA when the ratings drop and let's say USA doesn't crack the top 10 or top 20 in the weekly cable rankings. Tell that to USA. Tell that to USA when their TV contract with WWE comes due in 2019. Now, that third hour of Raw does bring in millions of dollars. I don't know what the exact number is, but it's a lot. But the company does not live or die based on that third hour. So the question is, are you willing to burn out or chase off a large segment of your audience for short-term gain? That $173 million that JBL cited in rights fees, okay, that's not all from the third hour. WWE, believe me, would still net themselves a pretty sweet deal with or without that third hour. But is the extra money that they make off of it worth it in the long run? They apparently think so. Fact is, if you are burning out or chasing off some of your fans, okay, maybe even a lot of fans, you're losing money in the long run from somewhere else. Because those people have given up. And they're probably not coming back. Vince McMahon, he cannibalized his pay-per-view business, which was their bread and butter for years and years before TV rights fees exploded. Why did he do it? Because he saw the future in them having their own network. This is the future. We have to do this. It's an investment in our future. He gave away his top pay-per-views for nothing. Gave WrestleMania away for free on a gamble that the network, in the long run, would pay off for them. And they're still waiting. I do think it will happen one day. But it hasn't happened yet. But he took that risk because he felt it was the right move to make for the long-term health of his company. Short-term hit for long-term gain. Now, either the money that they're making off this third hour has blinded them to that fact, or the stories were true, and it was USA that wanted them at 3 hours, not Vince, and so they had no say in the matter. Now, I'm with Rosenberg as far as the shows are far more tolerable at 2 hours. And let's be honest, there have been some good Raws, there have been a lot of bad Raws. And, look, if they had a compelling product, if they had a must-see product, then 3 hours might not be so bad. 2 hours does not cure all of their ills. You can have a shitty two-hour show. You can put on a boring two-hour show just as easily as you can a three-hour show. The stories still need to be compelling. You have to have stars that people want to see and that they want to get behind. But there is no doubt, I don't care what anybody says, there is no doubt that 3 hours has hurt Raw. Yeah, maybe right now so far, in terms of their bottom line, it hasn't hurt, but it is hurting this show. I saw Coach, Jonathan Coachman, who worked for the company for 10 years, works for ESPN now. He was on Busted Open. He was asked about the 3 hour Raws. He said the same thing. It's a mistake to do 3 hours, he said. And me personally, I think the fans are well within their right to feel that way. Just as Paul Heyman suggested, just as those same fans are free to not watch, right? That's what he said. Don't watch, boycott. That's what he said. Heyman made that point a few times, a little too flippantly, I thought, but he made that point a whole bunch of times. Well, if you don't like it, don't watch it. You should just boycott it. Otherwise, he said, STFU. That's what he said. He morphed into John Cena all of a sudden. With all due respect to Mr. Heyman, I would say that since 2001 or so, a few million of those fans have, in fact, boycotted the product. A large percentage of their audience has eroded over the last 15 years. Even longer. Even before Raw went to 3 hours. This isn't just a 3 hour problem. The last thing WWE should be doing is encouraging more people to boycott their product. Be careful what you wish for. Because when you start to lose those people, the hardcores, then you're in trouble. SmackDown Live. Twitter poll. Almost 2,000 votes. 95% thumbs up, 5% thumbs down. Wow. That is one of the most lopsided margins since I started doing these polls. I can think of only one better last year, 96 up, 4 down, for that first post-draft episode of Raw, where Finn Balor beat Roman Reigns. We had Baron Corbin beating Dolph Ziggler, which, to be fair, you know, if I'm going to blast Raw for all these combinations of Reigns and Jericho and Owens, I'm even sicker of Baron Corbin and Dolph Ziggler. The good news is, it would appear, based on what happened here, we may finally be at the end. Corbin beat Ziggler with the End of Days. Corbin grabbed a chair. He went to go after Dolph when the match was over. Kalisto ran out. Kalisto's had his own feud with Corbin, so it would make sense for him to come out. He comes out to make the Lucha save, and you might be wondering, well, what's a Lucha save? Lucha save meaning it did not end well for Kalisto, as these things normally do not end well for Kalisto. Dolph Ziggler turned heel. He did not appreciate Kalisto coming out to save him, and he super kicked him. Told him, I don't need your help. And this betrayal, this horrible betrayal by Dolph Ziggler to this wildly popular Lucha babyface was met by an arena full of yes chants. So, poor Kalisto. I actually don't think it's so much against Kalisto. It has more to do with the fact that I think people were just ready for a change with Dolph Ziggler. I think this is the best thing that could have happened to this guy. This is exactly what he needs. This guy needs an attitude adjustment. And I think this is going to do him a world of good. Now, obviously, it depends on how they book him. Just because he turned heel doesn't mean he's all of a sudden going to be this this great character who's involved in all these different things on the show and getting TV time. They turned him heel. And look, he could be stuck in mid-card hell and not even appear on the show next week. We don't know. But I do think that this is going to be a big positive for him. They followed it up with a backstage segment where Apollo Crews confronted him to ask, why'd you do what you did? And Ziggler ended up attacking him. So it's doubly good because what it does most likely is it gets Apollo Crews an opponent for television. Talk about guys that haven't been making appearances. This guy's been MIA for a while now. And so now it might get Apollo Crews on TV and give him something to do. So I think this is just a good thing all around. There was an excellent contract signing for the Royal Rumble with AJ Styles and John Cena. One of the things I love about SmackDown, and I want people to remember this, by the way, because every time I talk, you know, positively about WWE, it just makes me laugh that much more when I inevitably get messages from people saying, you're so negative. You just hate everything. You're so negative about the whole product. Why do you even watch? It's like they completely skip over the SmackDown review. It's very convenient. You know, people, they kind of live in like an echo chamber. They hear what they want to hear. So, yeah, you can just throw this review back in their face the next time they do that. But one of the things I love about SmackDown is how the authority figures, they usually keep to the background. They don't hog up all the oxygen. Like, we barely even see Shane McMahon at this point on the show. And we get Daniel Bryan in limited doses. He was out there to MC this segment, but then after the first few minutes, he just disappeared. I saw a microphone sitting on the table and just poof, he vanished. And they kept the focus on John Cena and AJ Styles, as they should have. Now, if this were Raw, Stephanie would be front and center for the whole thing, and Mick Foley would be off to the side reading crib notes off his hand while Stephanie berated him for it. So that's kind of refreshing about SmackDown. But I also love how Baron Corbin interrupted at the end. They planted this guy right in the middle of the title picture. You know, I know some people are not sold on him yet. I know some people think he's boring Corbin. But I think he's progressed nicely since coming up from NXT. And I've talked about his, you know, verbal skills, his promos. I've seen him on Talking Smack. He's good, man. I mean, he doesn't seem timid or shy or, you know, the thing about Baron Corbin is the way he comes off, he's the lone wolf, right? He doesn't have friends. He doesn't like people. He just wants to be the top guy and be the champ. Like, you listen to him even on Talking Smack and whenever they do these interviews with him, it seems like that's who he is. So either he's a really good actor and that's just, you know, the role he's portraying and he's completely the opposite off camera, or I think there's a lot of him in this character, so it's easy for him to just go out there and be who he is. Like, look, this guy sucks, I'm better, I'm going to be the champ. Like, maybe he really feels that way. Maybe, you know, maybe he feels like he's entitled or he, I don't know, but I think that he has improved a great deal since he's come up from NXT. And I do see him, look, that's why I predicted last week when I did the prediction show, to me, he's going to be Mr. Money in the Bank this year. And once he cashes in, whether it's this year or next year, he will be WWE champion. They're going to get that belt on him, and it's not going to be that far into the future. And at that point, we'll see what he does when he's put in that kind of role. But they've got this guy fast-tracked. He's on the way. And the cool thing about it is it's some new blood. Now they are trying this now on Raw with Braun Strowman, and Strowman is getting over. So I will give them credit for that even on Raw. They're finally trying to inject some new blood and get somebody new over, and it seems to be working. And I think they're doing something similar with Corbin on SmackDown. Who's going to get there first? Is it going to be Strowman? Is Strowman a long-term thing, or is Strowman just a short-term project to have Roman Reigns beat him at WrestleMania? You know, I don't know. Corbin is more of a long-term project to me. I think going forward long-term, he could be a big star. I don't see him winning the title right now. But again, by mid-year, yeah, I think we'll see him kind of in that mix. The La Luchadora stuff continued on this show. Becky was wrestling La Luchadora. At one point, La Luchadora disappeared under the ring and reemerged on the other side. Clearly, it was someone different. Becky tapped her out anyway with the disarmer, unmasked her. It was Alexa Bliss. Then the actual La Luchadora reappeared, and she and Alexa beat the hell out of Becky. I would kind of laugh if La Luchadora turned out to be Sasha Banks. Remember, I mentioned before, sad tweet of the week. She tweeted, "I miss NXT." Yeah. The story writes itself. I mean, come on. The story is that this woman will do anything to get away from Raw and working with Nia Jax. She just wants to get away from Raw. And it just turns out, like, as a tribute to her idol, Eddie Guerrero, she invented the La Luchadora gimmick. And then when she gets unmasked, ultimately, she can beg Daniel Bryan to let her stay on SmackDown. And Bryan can work out a deal, right, with Mick Foley. Can we keep Sasha? And Mick agrees to it in exchange for a mystery star who debuts on Raw. And it turns out to be Mickie James. And so Mickie James goes to Raw. Sasha's now a heel on SmackDown. I don't even know what the hell I'm saying. I'm just kind of rambling on. But I just came up with that now. But that's actually not half bad of an idea. So Dean Ambrose, he beat The Miz. In kind of a surprise, I was not expecting this. He is the new Intercontinental Champion. Good main event. I could see them because they're continuing the whole thing with Renee. There was a segment on the show where Maryse went right up to Renee Young backstage and smacked her right across the face and said, "Don't ever put your hands on my man again." And I could see them ultimately doing some kind of a mixed tag match with its, you know, with Ambrose and Renee against Miz and Maryse, maybe at WrestleMania. Maybe they keep this Ambrose-Miz feud going for a couple more months. They do the mixed tag at WrestleMania. They could even put the Intercontinental title on the line if they want to. And I could see it going down that road. I mean, Renee is not a wrestler. So the whole idea of, well, maybe they'll do Renee against Maryse. Yeah, I guess they could, but that would suck. It would be terrible. Maryse wrestled for years. Renee has never wrestled a match in her life. The only person she's ever wrestled is Dean Ambrose. So to me, you put him in a tag match, and that way, yeah, it could be a fun little attraction. I could see a mixed tag happening at some point. So those are the key things on SmackDown. I enjoyed it. I thought it was, 95% up, 5 down. That's a hell of a thumbs up, thumbs down ratio. But I just thought it was another, you know, enjoyable 2 hours, and hopefully they can keep the momentum going. The contract signing was the highlight of the show. I would encourage everybody to go watch that if you haven't seen it. I thought Styles was great. I thought John Cena was fantastic. You know, John Cena, when he's motivated and he gets going in these promos and he gets away from, "Oh, the fans can boo me or cheer. They could boo and cheer whoever they want." Oh, God, I heard that. How many times have we heard John Cena talk about that? Thankfully, he didn't get into that whole thing on this show. But when John Cena is on, when he's on point, he's great. And I thought that contract signing got me even more interested to see their match at the Royal Rumble, even though I've already seen them wrestle a whole bunch of times. They made this thing feel like a really big deal. And every time John Cena challenges for the championship, and it may just last one match because he may win in San Antonio, but now every time he wrestles for that title, it's going to be an attraction, if for no other reason, because there's going to be people out there who really, really want to see him tie Ric Flair or really, really don't want to see him tie Ric Flair. It's kind of like when The Undertaker still had the streak. people did not want that streak to end. There was this element of drama every time he was this close to being pinned. I think you're going to have some of that with John Cena. More so from the vocal fans who just absolutely do not want him to touch the phony Ric Flair record. So it just makes it that much more of an attraction. NXT, I'm not even gonna play the music. I didn't see it this week. I did not have time to watch the show. This was a show that was taped about a month ago from Melbourne, Australia. I already saw the main event. That was the cage match with Nakamura and Joe. So I already saw that. Hopefully I'll have time to go back and watch it this week, the rest of the show. But they are back with an all-new show this Wednesday from Full Sail. It's going to be DIY defending the tag team titles against the Revival. I will definitely be watching that. But there is some NXT news. And this next item is technically a spoiler, even though WWE are the ones who went and spoiled it. So if you went on WWE.com, if you went on their social media, you've already been spoiled. But for those who don't know, you can skip ahead by a few minutes. You've been warned. There was a big return at the NXT tapings this week. I think it might have been a dark segment when the show was over. I don't know if this will air on TV or not. But Chris Hero made his return to NXT at the tapings this past week. And he is back to using his old name of Cassius Ohno, which he portrayed Cassius Ohno down in NXT for a number of years, about three years ago, probably since he's been there. And so what it also means now is we've got two men using the KO initials in WWE. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I'm also not going to spend more than 5 seconds complaining about it because it's not that big of a deal. There were a lot of people very upset by the fact that they're not letting this guy be Chris Hero, which could well be his decision. You know, they already let this guy go once. I mean, think about this. They let this guy go once, and he was able to go back to being Chris Hero because he didn't sign his life. He didn't sign the rights to his name and his whole identity over to WWE. Maybe it was his call. We don't know. Because in the back of his mind, if it happened to him once, it could happen again. So at least, God forbid, if something happens and I find myself out of NXT for a second time, I can just go back to being Chris Hero in the indies and doing pretty well for myself. So I would just tell people to, like, just calm down. It's not that big of a deal. Who cares what they call him? What matters is that they have righted a major wrong by bringing this guy back. He is a very talented guy. He never should have been released in the first place. Now he's back. That's all that matters. And at a time when NXT could really use him, because NXT has lost a lot of people. And I still think Joe is going to debut in the Rumble or whenever. He's got to be coming up soon. There's nothing left for Samoa Joe to do or to accomplish in NXT. So I don't think that they're done taking people from there. And when you take people from NXT, you've got to replenish people. And they do have to start featuring more of their own guys from the Performance Center. It can't just be, you know, their own little indie promotion. But they really need guys like Chris Hero and a Roderick Strong. They got to bring guys like that in. Adam Cole, I think, may be on his way in a few months. And then those guys can work with the guys from the Performance Center. So I think this is just a positive in every way. But the name thing, again, just, you know, I spent 5 seconds thinking, man, that's dumb. And then I got over it. Look, I mean, Tommy End. People talk about this Tommy End guy, right, from the UK. They just gave Tommy End a new name. Now he's Aleister Black. That's what they do. They rebrand people. Now, why do they do it with some and not others? I don't know. I mean, that's a judgment that they make. But I would imagine these guys not wanting to give up their identity has as much to do with it as anything else. Hero walked out. He was wearing a suit. He confronted Shinsuke Nakamura in the middle of the ring. He did not cut a promo. He didn't say a word. He just kind of patted the NXT title. And then he left the ring. And WWE, if you want to see it, they put the whole video up on their Facebook page. It may be up on their YouTube channel now. He's already started working house shows. He had a match with Andrade Cien Almas the other night that he won. I thought it was funny because he was wearing his Chris Hero tights. So that was, even though they're calling him Cassius Ohno, so that was kind of funny. He is finishing up with Evolve, Royal Rumble weekend, their shows in San Antonio. Of course, Evolve has the working relationship with WWE. So I suppose if Evolve wanted to use him a little more often, they could probably just go to Triple H and say, hey, you know, we want to use him. But he will be in town. The point is that he will be in town in San Antonio Royal Rumble weekend, and they're doing a takeover show that weekend. And so if they wanted to do something with him or have him make an appearance on that show, they could do that. Obviously, the match in San Antonio is Bobby Roode against Nakamura for the title. You got to think that if he gets past Roode, which I think he will, we'll see in a few weeks when I do predictions. I'm thinking Bobby Roode ain't winning that title. And if Nakamura retains, I think we could be very well looking at Nakamura against Hiro over WrestleMania weekend in Orlando. And I think that would be a hell of a match. TNA. Anthem made it official this week with the announcement that they have officially acquired Impact Wrestling. It is official. It is a done deal. And thank you to Adam on Twitter for being the first to point out to me that Anthem, spelled backwards, is meh TNA. Which is honestly the funniest thing I've heard all year, although admittedly the year is only 8 days old. The announcement also noted that Dixie Carter will be resigning from her position as chairman of Impact Ventures. Although she will remain a minority stakeholder in the company, she will no longer have any power at all whatsoever. No influence over creative decisions or hiring decisions. She's apparently not even welcome backstage anymore. So Dixie is done. She is gone, finally. TNA is free to move on to the next fresh fit. Oh, wait. There's more. The other big story, which is that Jeff Jarrett, one of the founding fathers of TNA and the Gold Rush of 2016, has returned to the company as a consultant. He and Dutch Mantel both were at the tapings in Orlando this past week. Mantel, the former Zeb Coulter in WWE. He worked in TNA alongside Jarrett many, many years ago. I have seen him credited with the idea to have Kurt Angle and Samoa Joe have that MMA-style feud they had back in, 2008, maybe 2009. It was when they had that cage match at Lockdown, which led to the biggest pay-per-view number the company ever did. So naturally, they never did anything like that again. And he was fired. I don't think he was... It was long after that he was fired. It was around the time that Jarrett, I think, fell out of favor politically with Dixie when he lied to her about the whole Kurt and Karen Angle drama. So that could be a positive thing, having him back in the fold. Mantel, that is. But to me, whether it's Dutch Mantel or Jeff Jarrett, you know, going back to the old guard, like especially Jarrett, he's been in, he's been out, in and out over the years. He represents the past. He represents the past. I want to see what great success that TNA had while led by Jeff Jarrett. Maybe it turns out to be a good thing. We'll see. But, like, I want to see the evidence of, like, well, Jeff Jarrett is back. This is going to be a good thing. Why? What makes you think that it's going to be any different? Where is this great success that the company had under his watch? What, the X Division was prominently featured? Really? Is that their big claim to fame, this company? I mean, I'm looking at this and I'm just thinking, they finally got a fresh start, right? I'm looking at this. They finally sold to a new owner. They got Dixie out of power, which has been years and years and years in the making. Billy Corgan was new. I mean, he had some new ideas, but he's booted out of the picture for obvious reasons. And the first thing they do is they bring back Jeff Jarrett. It seems backwards to me. And I said on Twitter, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same, which in and of itself is not necessarily a criticism. That's literally all I tweeted was PW Insider said that Jeff Jarrett is back. The more things change, the more they stay the same. And yet you had to see some of these TNA diehards, their heads exploded. They get so easily triggered when you say anything that could be construed as being even the slightest bit negative about TNA. It's the most hilarious thing. And I hope TNA lives forever. I hope TNA lives forever, if only because if it ever does die, what the hell are these people going to do with themselves? TNA is seemingly the sole purpose for their existence. If TNA goes away, what the hell do they do? I just hope they all wear Velcro sneakers and they don't have shoelaces. I will say, you know, one good thing to come from this is if TNA takes on the Global Force Wrestling name, not the Global Force, I mean, global force, global farce, call it whatever you want. It doesn't exactly have a big profile, but it also doesn't have the stain that the TNA initials have. Because people have been asking me, like, what does this mean for GFW? Does that mean it's dead? Is it merging with TNA? Are they going to do an invasion? First of all, invade with what? I don't know what the future holds for Global Force. But if it ends with TNA's name, the TNA initials being retired, then to me, that's a good thing. Those initials are poison at this point, okay? They are rat poison. And they need a new name. They need a rebranding. The best thing they could do would be to rebrand things. And if they do that with the GFW name, I think that's a positive thing. There. See? I said something positive. Mark Andrews, by the way. Mandrews. Does he really call himself Mandrews? It's a terrible name. Winner of their second season of British Boot Camp. He is gone from TNA. His contract expired at the end of the year, and so he bolted. WWE just added him to their UK tournament, which is coming up next weekend. So if you are a Mandrews fan, that's where you can see him. Lucha Underground. We had Sexy Star beating Mariposa in the opener, double foot stomp. After the match, the real news coming out of this is that when the match was over, Mariposa's brother, Marty the Moth, came out to help her up, and then he violently chokeslammed her, which got chants of holy shit from the crowd. Paul London was back with the rest of his rabbit tribe. They took on Cobra Moon's team of Drago, who they dragged out there on a chain around his neck, like a dog leash. Pindar, I believe, is the name of one of her other manservants and the other creepy lizard dude. Drago got the win for his team with a blockbuster DDT. Phoenix and Aerostar made their way out to save their friend. They tried to rescue Drago, but Drago looked unsure of who to go with. So it might be fucking with his mind a little bit. He's been in captivity for a little too long. I'm not a fan of this story. The tall dude with the lizard mask, the mask looks cool. That's about the only thing I really like out of this whole thing. This just ain't doing it for me. We got another horribly acted segment backstage with Sexy Star and the Mac. You know, like in a twisted kind of way, these are some of the things I look forward to the most on this show when they do these segments with the Mac and Sexy Star. I've seen porn scenes that have better acting than this. He told her, go home. I don't want you to come out and help me in my title match with Johnny Mundo. The Mac also met with Dario Cueto, who told him that his title match tonight with Johnny Mundo would in fact not be for the Lucha Underground title. Instead, the winner would get to pick the stipulation for their actual title match. So a little bait and switch here on this show. And then in the main event, Johnny Mundo pinned the Mac with a low blow and a cradle after Jack Evans and PJ Black provided the distraction. So we got a bait and switch. We got a roll-up finish. I don't like where this is going here. This is a little too WWE-esque for my liking. No Sexy Star to help him. He got his ass beaten down, the Mac did, when the match was over, because he told Sexy to go home, so he had no backup. Mundo mocked him after the match for not even lasting 10 minutes. Mundo says, I'm going to take you to Slamtown all night long. So their match is going to be an all-night-long, which is basically an Iron Man match, for the championship. The all-night-long match that Mundo had with Prince Puma was really, really good, so I have high hopes. I mean, I'm not... The Mac is a talented guy. He ain't no Prince Puma, but I still have high hopes for this match. So Mil Muertes and Katrina walk out, and Mil makes a beeline for Vampiro at the announce desk. Katrina told him earlier in the show, she told Mil, you know, Vampiro is the one who's been mentoring Prince Puma. And so now Mil Muertes just wants to kill Vampiro, and Puma comes out to try to save Vamp. Vamp says, back off, don't help me. And he watches on as Mil Muertes delivers a flatliner and lays out Vampiro while Puma looks on, and that's how the show ends. So just a pretty ho-hum episode. Nothing great, nothing terrible, just kind of there. Apparently, the mid-season finale is coming up this Wednesday, so next weekend is going to be the end of the Lucha Underground reviews for a while. I know the show's going on hiatus. I know the rest of the season is already in the can. It's already taped, so it really is just a matter of when they decide to air it next. So this is going to be the last of Lucha Underground for a while. Let's get to your mailbag questions. If you have them, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. We will start here with Carlos from New York. With WWE talents making it known they checked out Wrestle Kingdom 11, particularly the Okada Omega match, and Vince McMahon's desire to top New Japan, I don't know where you got that from. How do you think WWE would attempt to do it at WrestleMania? And how would you go about trying to top the New Japan show? I don't think there is topping the New Japan show. You could try. I'm not saying they should not try to put on their best show. It's funny to me, like, first of all, I don't think Vince McMahon even cares. Like, I really, like, I don't even think he knows about Wrestle Kingdom. If you said the word Wrestle Kingdom to him, he wouldn't have know what the fuck that is. Triple H does. But I doubt Vince does. Vince seems like the kind of guy who is in his own bubble, and Triple H is aware of the indies. He's aware of other promotions. I mean, look, Vince obviously is familiar with TNA. He's familiar with ROH. Triple H is familiar with all the others and their own writers, some of whom, like, I know Jimmy Jacobs is a writer for them, and he worked for some of these other promotions. So the writers are pretty plugged into what's going on and pretty plugged into other products, as they should be. But Vince himself, I doubt he knows and I doubt he cares. And these reports that came out this week, I don't know where these came from. I find these so funny. These reports that the writers saw Kenny Omega against Okada and now they're determined to make WrestleMania a great show. It's like, shouldn't that be their goal every year? To make WrestleMania as great as it can possibly be? Like, what is this nonsense? You know what? You want an answer? Honestly, I don't know that I see a main event. Like, I'm looking at potential main event matches, just using guys that are currently on the main roster. And yes, maybe Joe or Nakamura comes up before then. I don't think Nakamura does. But I'm looking at the rosters, and there's a lot of talented guys. Unless they start mixing and matching Raw and SmackDown guys, I honestly don't think there's any main event they could put on that's going to top what New Japan did this past week. You want to have a match, though, on that card that just knocks people's socks off. It's not a main event. It's an undercard match. But to me, their best shot, honestly, would be to get Kota Ibushi to come in for WrestleMania. They've gotten him for other shows. Bring him in for Mania. Put him against Neville for the Cruiserweight title. Get that title on Neville soon. And book Neville against Ibushi for the Cruiserweight title at WrestleMania. No restrictions. Let them go out there and do their thing. So it's not the main event, but if you want a blowaway match on that show that people, you know, that gets people talking, that's the one that I would do. But I don't see any main event offhand that I think they could put together in time for this year that could top what we saw last week. But you know what? It'll be fun to watch them try. Alice from Manchester, England. I'm 19 and my brother Aiden absolutely loves listening to your sound off. Well, thank you. Shout out to Aiden. My question is about Undertaker retiring with the world title at WrestleMania. I personally think it would be the perfect way to end the dead man's career. Do you think this would be something that could work? Yeah, I mean, look, you can get anything to work if you do it the right way. It's not like people are going to revolt if they put the title on Undertaker and that's his last stand and then the championship goes up for grabs in a tournament. I mean, yes, you could do that. I wouldn't do that. But if they were going to do it, okay, it's like, okay, he's going to win the championship. So who does he face? Well, I've been saying it's going to be John Cena and The Undertaker at WrestleMania. And so, yeah, I guess if John Cena were to win the title in the Alamo Dome, you could do Undertaker challenging for the title and have him beat Cena at WrestleMania. And actually, him beating Cena as opposed to losing to Cena would probably make a lot more people happy. But if they were to go with your idea, I'm going to break my own rule. Because people know my thoughts on having multi-man matches as a WrestleMania main event. They've had a couple of really great triple threat matches before. But generally speaking, I'm not a fan of that. Because I'd rather the main event of WrestleMania be one-on-one. Yes, the match they had at WrestleMania 20 with Triple H and Shawn Michaels and He Who Shall Not Be Named was a great match. It was a great match. And WrestleMania 30, Daniel Bryan, Batista, and Randy Orton turned out to be a great match. So it is possible, but in this case, I might be willing to say, okay, you want to have a great main event at WrestleMania. You know what I think could be a great main event? And you could get the title on Taker if you want. Undertaker, John Cena, and AJ Styles in a triple threat match. If that's the idea you want to go with, that's the match that I would do. So yeah, how's that for an idea? And then you can have Undertaker win the championship there. AJ gets his WrestleMania main event, which, let's be honest, I mean, the guy deserves it. The guy deserves it. But you get all three in that match, and you have the title on Undertaker, and he rides off into the sunset. Adnan in the UK. With the UK Championship Tournament being held this week, do you think it would be a good idea for the winner to be a surprise entrant in the Royal Rumble? I feel a good showing from the champion could help massively if they are going to set up a weekly network show. Yeah, you know, I guess if, you know, I guess they could, but they would have to, whoever wins this UK tournament next weekend would have to go into the Rumble and have like an unbelievably great showing. They'd have to dump out a few big names or at least like one really big name to really like make a name for themselves. Because otherwise, I don't really see what good it does. If you've got this brand new UK champion who just won this tournament, and you're going to have a weekly show, and you're going to build it around this person, what good does it do them to just put them in the Royal Rumble, have them walk out to crickets, if people don't know who he is, and then get dumped out like a loser after a few minutes? Because he ain't winning, so already you know going in, he's going into a match he can't win. Unless they're really going to put the guy over strong, I would keep him out of the Rumble myself. Chiron from Denver. I wonder if it's Chiron or Kieron. I'm going to say Chiron. How invested do you feel WWE is with Bray Wyatt? While he has yet to win a match at WrestleMania, they've given him matches and segments with three of the top 10 stars in WWE history, with John Cena, Undertaker, and The Rock. I feel he's one of the top five most important full-time stars in the company right now. What say you? Well, I will say that I disagree with that last point, but I will say this, and I've said this before. I said this a long time ago, that the two guys that I see this company building around for the future and who I think could end up or would end up being their biggest stars within however many years, 5 years, whatever it was, because I said this at least a couple years ago, was Roman Reigns and Bray Wyatt. And Bray Wyatt, I think the real money in Bray Wyatt is as a babyface. I mean, it's funny, you know, I think back to the stare down he had last year with Triple H when Triple H had the title. And there was a segment, I think it was on Raw, and the Wyatts came face to face with Triple H, and Bray came face to face with Triple H and kind of looked at the title, and people went nuts. That to me was a sign. Just reinforces what I thought all along, that this guy's got money written all over him. They bungled him a whole bunch of times. They really have. They've really done him no favors. Now he's kind of doing something cool, the whole Randy Orton storyline. I've been digging it. So I do think that there is a lot of money being left on the table with this guy right now. But to call him one of the top five most important guys they've got right now on the roster, I don't agree with that. To me, the litmus test I would use is if you erase this guy from the roster today, or if he went down with a major injury and he was gone for a year, how badly does it affect their roster? How noticeable is that loss? How much does it sting? And that includes live events. By those measures, to me, if you're asking me, the five most important people right now at this moment in that company on the main roster, full-time or relatively full-time, are John Cena, Roman Reigns, AJ Styles, Seth Rollins, and Dean Ambrose. Ambrose has worked more matches in the last year than anyone else in that company. He has been the Iron Man in that company. I wish I had the number in front of me. Somebody added up all the matches he's had. It's like, it blew my mind. You don't realize how valuable he really is. So I think Bray Wyatt could absolutely be one of those guys, and I do think he's valuable to them if you want to look at him. It's funny, I look at him almost still as a prospect because I still feel like there's a lot of potential there that they haven't tapped into. And if they could ever get there, he could be one of the biggest stars in the entire promotion. Fadi from Dubai, is Roman Reigns, he says, the modern day equivalent of early 1990s Lex Luger. Both have great physiques, the superstar look, and seem poised for success. Yet Luger failed to become the guy, and Roman is having trouble reaching that level. Or, well, I mean, he is the guy. You don't have to like him. He is the guy. He's not getting over the way they had hoped. Anyway, he says, whose fault is that? Is it Luger or Reigns' fault for what happened, or is it management's crappy booking? Yeah, you know, I do think there are similarities. I don't want to offend Roman Reigns, because I almost think, like, comparing him to Lex Luger is an insult to Roman. But there are similarities here, and I think back to, you know, we got the Royal Rumble coming up, and I think back to the Royal Rumble in 1994. So if you look back, they lost Hogan, and they decided to take Lex Luger, who was the narcissist, he was a heel, and out of nowhere, he shows up on a helicopter, and he's a babyface. He's the all-American babyface, and they put him on the Lex Express, and put him, you know, in the championship match with Yokozuna at SummerSlam, and what a fuck-up that was, because if their plan was to get this guy over as the next Hogan and the next top guy, he beats Yokozuna by count-out in the SummerSlam main event and celebrates like he won the championship. Balloons are falling, wrestlers come out, they hoist him up on their shoulders. Even as a kid, I'm watching this thinking, what the hell are you doing, dude? You didn't win the title, you're a loser. So, they go on, we get to the Royal Rumble, and it's patently obvious that the people are far more into Bret Hart than they are Lex Luger. And that was actually the reason why they did the finish the way they did, where they both go out, they tease Luger won, then they say, no, Bret won. Go back and look at the crowd reactions. The crowd was way more into Bret winning that match than Luger. And I think at that point, the die was cast. That was it. And they knew, okay, we got to build this new generation around Bret and not Lex, because Bret's over and Lex, he's over, but not at that level. And I think back to the Royal Rumble when Roman won a couple of years ago. And Roman wins and he's just showered by boos. But go back a year before that. Go back to 2014 and excluding Daniel Bryan from that Royal Rumble and poor Rey Mysterio coming out at number 30 and getting booed out of the building. Not because they hate Rey Mysterio, but because he wasn't Daniel Bryan. Who were the final two in that Rumble? Roman Reigns, who was still like the young new guy, and Batista. And the people all of a sudden got behind Roman Reigns. Now, part of that was that they resented Batista. They felt like Batista was taking up a spot that Bryan deserved. And so they were anti-Batista, right? It was Bautista. But part of it was Roman Reigns still had not been, ruined, but he was still kind of a badass and wasn't being shoved down people's throats in a way that they weren't happy with. I mean, silent assassin badass Roman Reigns is somebody that people got behind, and the Shield was over, and they looked at Roman and they said, okay, we want this guy to win. And they're cheering for Roman and they were pissed when he didn't win. Fast forward a year later and you ask yourself, what the hell happened? Well, it's the booking. And it's the same thing with Luger. I think they really missed the boat by not putting that title on him at SummerSlam. They fucked up. Now, maybe the end result would have been the same. People were still more into Bret. We'll never know. But I don't think that the result of that match at SummerSlam did him any favors. It made him look like an idiot. And I don't think the booking of Roman Reigns did him any favors either. That's why people get so upset at Roman. It's like, what? He didn't do anything. Like, what are you so pissed at him for? You know what I mean? Roman Reigns, when he has matches, when he has big time matches, Roman Reigns has great matches. Not every single week. But he's had far more great matches, in my opinion, than crappy matches. So this idea that you can't wrestle, it's like people chant that at John Cena and they're fucking dumb. It's like, again, they just chant it because they're lashing out at these guys. I don't blame Roman. I blame the way that they've booked him. I blame the way that they've handled him. And all that shit with the tater tots and the suffering succotash and the Jack and the Beanstalk story and that whole phase he went through where Vince was supposedly writing his promos for him, it fucked this guy up royally. And I still don't think he's recovered from that. But I think it goes all the way back to the Rumble in 2015, because it was Daniel Bryan all over again, the way they dumped Bryan out of the match. And people were absolutely enraged. And unfortunately for Roman Reigns, he was the guy like Batista the year before who felt the brunt of that. So I do think that if you're talking about kind of botched booking, there are a lot of similarities that can be made in terms of mishandling Luger and mishandling Roman Reigns. But on the flip side of that, you say, well, is Roman Reigns the modern day equivalent of Lex Luger? And I just think that that's an insult to Roman Reigns, because to me, Roman Reigns is a far better wrestler than Lex Luger. Luger looked the part. He looked like a million bucks. You couldn't sculpt a better pro wrestler than Lex Luger. And Luger did have some great matches. I'm not saying every match the guy had was a dud. He was a capable professional wrestler, and I think also depending on who he was in there with, he had classic matches with Ric Flair and people. But again, it's not hard to have a classic match back then with Ric Flair. But I don't think back to very many, excellent wrestling matches that I go back and have a tendency to want to, rewatch that Lex Luger was involved in. Roman Reigns has had a whole string of great matches with different people. And everybody has their own criteria for what makes a great pro wrestler. It's a subjective thing. I look at Roman Reigns and I think he's a better pro wrestler than Lex Luger. My opinion maybe, but that's how I feel. Way more entertaining matches than the ones Lex has had. I can tell you that. So I almost think like it's kind of a shot at Roman Reigns, and I wouldn't take it that far. But yeah, there are other similarities between the way that the two of them have been booked, and I wouldn't lay that on them. I would lay that on management. I would lay that on Vince. I mean, let's be honest, it's Vince. Jay from Cardiff, Wales. After scrolling through some TNA videos on YouTube out of boredom, I came across some clips of Eli Drake. In my opinion, he's one of the best they have on that roster. He's like a mix of Stone Cold and The Rock from when The Rock first turned heel way back when. But I hardly ever hear you mention his name, since any TNA-related news is usually concerning broken Matt Hardy. Where is the love for Eli Drake? He could be a legit top star in WWE if they ever chose to re-sign him. Are you serious, dude? I literally just put the guy over 3 episodes ago. I even played audio from a show I did 2 years ago when I first put him over. You gotta pay closer attention. It's like the timing of this question. I saw this and I shook my head. I'm like, Jay, come on, man. Are you for real? Episode 474. It was not that long ago. It's in the archives. Go check it out. Mauricio from Santiago, Chile. I've been listening to your podcast for the last 2 years, and this week I've been listening to the first 4 episodes to check out the show's format from that time and remind myself of how things were in WWE back then. On episode 4, you talked about how belts do not mean as much when almost every match on a card is for a title. Can you explain that again? How does having belts defended too much make them less relevant? I think if you could explain your point of view on how to actually make a belt feel more important, that would be great. You mentioned Ring of Honor and how they make their belts important. Maybe the comment was related to how they were and still are 2 world champions. I hope my question was not too confusing. No, it's not confusing. I got your question and I don't remember. I should have gone back and listened to the show, but I didn't. I just don't remember exactly what I said. I mean, episode 4 of the Sound Off would have been 2007. That's 10 years ago. So I'll just come at it from the point of view, I think, of what I probably said. I think that, yes, part of it was the fact that back then you still had the brand split. You had 2 titles. I was never a fan of that. I think having 2 quote-unquote world titles, I guess now we have a title of the universe, whatever the hell. But I think it dilutes them. I really do. It could benefit some guys. Some guys get to hold it who otherwise may never have gotten the chance to be a world champion. That's good for them. But I do think it dilutes things when you have 2 world champions like that. So that's part of it. I don't think that I would have... And actually, while I'm on that subject, there's one other thing that doesn't help. And we've seen this a lot lately. That whole list I ran down before of all the matches we've seen with Kevin Owens and Roman Reigns going back 5 months. Kevin Owens lost a decent number of those. And he's the champ. And one thing I've never been a fan of is just beating the world champion in non-title matches on TV, unless it immediately, you turn around and it leads to a championship match for that person. That at least would make sense. A lot of times it doesn't. You just beat them. It's a non-title match. Who cares? And it pisses me off. You're the world champ. The world champ should not be getting pinned on TV in a non-title match unless it's immediately going to lead to something. There's a million other guys that you could do that with. You don't do that with your world champ. And this is not a recent phenomenon. They've done this for years. So that doesn't help. But I'm not sure the point that I was making at the time had to do with the belts being defended too much, so much as there being too many of them. And also, here's another point that I want to make about the brand split and why I was happy it died the first time. It got to a point, it was so bad, and they had such little regard for that World Heavyweight title, and SmackDown as a whole. I remember a time when Alberto Del Rio had the World Heavyweight title. And by this point, there was no, we have to keep the brands separate. Like, they didn't give a shit at this point. They were mixing guys every single week left and right. It was a brand split in name only before they finally killed it. So you have Del Rio with the big gold belt, a SmackDown guy, their world champ, on Raw. And I'm not even talking about that one Raw where he was on stage like all the rest of the geeks just standing there as they were waiting to announce the number one contender for the actual title that mattered, the WWE title. I'm not even talking about that. I know Del Rio was on stage for that. There was a Raw where Del Rio opened the show, first match of the night on Raw, defending the world title. I forgot against who. Could have been Sheamus. I don't remember. Like, it was just an opening match. This is a World Heavyweight Championship match, and this guy is out there in the opening segment on Raw, just defending the title in a nothing match that nobody cared about. And I remember thinking to myself, why do they even have a world title at this point? Why? Is it just for house shows? Is that it? I mean, do they look at the numbers and see that we have to have a title match on the live events? Because to some people, that still matters, and that could be the difference between selling 4,500 tickets to a show and 3,500 tickets to a show? I'd like to know, because by the end there, it made no sense whatsoever. I was so happy when they went back to having one title, and I was so disheartened when they announced that they were going back to two. Because I thought back to that, and I said, oh my God, like these are the same people that booked it the first time, and they don't know what the fuck they're doing. And it's still too early to make a judgment call. This thing isn't even a year old on the current brand split, but I remember the old one, and it didn't go so well. First few years, okay. After that, it was all downhill. And so I think that was probably as big a part of it as anything. When I made those comments, it was 2007. We were right in the middle of the brand split, and by then, it was probably already going down. I mean, by that point, they probably had very little regard for that world title as compared to, you know, the title that John Cena was holding. So I think that's as much to do with it as anything. The whole idea of having too many titles, and why is that a bad thing? Because if everybody, it's like everybody gets a belt, right? If everybody gets a belt, it's you're devaluing at least the top ones. You are devaluing them in some way if you have a card of six matches. Say it's a B-show pay-per-view. You've got six matches. Night of Champions. It's a great example. Every match is for a championship. All right, well, if every match is for a championship, well, it's not very exciting. Some people might disagree with me. Oh, it's very exciting. Every match is for a title. I don't know. I mean, to me, if you had a card with tag team title, one mid-card title, and you had your crown jewel, and you made that crown jewel to be the most important thing in the world, I mean, think back to WWE, end of 1996, beginning of 1997. That cluster of about four or five guys that had a chip on their shoulder. They were pissed off at the world. That, you know, being the real start to me of the Attitude Era. Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, Sid, Undertaker, Austin, that cluster of guys. They were all at each other's throats. It was all about the championship. That was the richest prize in the world to those guys. It was all about the title. And I think as the years have gone on, they've added more belts. And even the focus on their main title has not always been there. It just doesn't seem to mean what it once did. And I'm thinking that was the point that I was probably making. But I do think there is something to be said if you have a card and you have your top title at the top and you know, maybe a couple of other championship matches for the, you know, the women's and, you know, the other lower card belt. But to just have title matches all the time, after a while, you get kind of numb. Every match is a championship match. Everybody gets a belt. What does it really mean? You know, Ring of Honor, especially back then, I mean, Ring of Honor, their title matches, I mean, they had a reputation of just being out of this world, fantastic, you know, the work rate and all that. That's what Ring of Honor was known for. Ring of Honor also had, I think, two titles. They had the Ring of Honor title and the tag team titles. I don't even know at the time if they had that, remember that Pure title they had? They may not have even had that. It was just the Ring of Honor title. That's what they had. And that thing was what everybody was fighting for, and it meant the world to those guys. And when you had a Ring of Honor title match, you knew you were in for something special. I went to a lot of those shows. Those shows kicked ass. So I think all of those points kind of factor into it. Right now, I do think that the championship, the whole Kevin Owens, Chris Jericho, Roman Reigns thing, and all the matches that they've had, and just, you know, having Roman beat him and beat him and beat him a number of times on TV, and now he gets a championship match at the Rumble after all these months. He already had one at the last pay-per-view, and but just having all these matches in the interim, and you put these guys together in the ring, when you get to pay-per-view, who cares? Who cares? Because we've seen these guys a gazillion times on TV for free in the ring together, whether it's for the title or not, who gives a shit? We've already seen it. So what does it really mean? So I think those are kind of the points that I was trying to make. Kent from Philadelphia, if the first Persian Gulf War never happened, what would have been the main event of WrestleMania 7? Well, Bruce Pritchard claims the original plan, believe it or not, was to do Hulk Hogan and Tugboat. With Tugboat, you know, he was like best friends with Hogan. He would turn on Hogan and then get the big monster push, like kind of the one Earthquake got the year before. What a freaking disaster that would have been, Hogan and Tugboat as a WrestleMania main event. Not to say that the main event with Sergeant Slaughter was much better, or that Slaughter was, you know, an infinitely better choice. He was still a better choice than Tugboat would have been. Imagine that, though. Hogan and the Shockmaster in the WrestleMania main event. We may never have gotten the Shockmaster if that happened. Arnez, I was having an exchange with a buddy who was watching Hulk Hogan in WCW around 1994 and was noticing the boos that he was receiving. I mentioned that people were sick of the vitamins and prayers and how Hogan going heel was the best thing for him 2 years later. I thought to myself later on how different wrestling would look today if Vince McMahon had turned Hogan heel instead of Eric Bischoff back in the 90s. No doubt it got WCW to the promised land for a while, but how would that have impacted wrestling as a whole if Vince and WWE did it first? Oh, it would have changed the face of wrestling is what it would have done. I think Vince had the chance to turn Hogan heel or begin a heel turn with Hogan in 92. It was very obvious that there was a segment of the audience that was sick of this guy. I mean, look at the reaction when he got dumped out of the ring of the Rumble in 92. I mean, that should have been a telltale sign right there. But Hogan, you know, all the steroid stuff, he had to go away for a while, so he took a year off. But that would have been the time to do it. Vince could have done it. I think he could have done it. Had he done it, we wouldn't have gotten the Monday Night Wars that we got. Because Vince turning Hogan heel in 92, while I do think it could have worked, there's no way that it would have been anything close to what it was in WCW with him going heel. It had to be Bischoff. And the reason is, Hogan was part of this perceived invasion. People actually thought that Hall and Nash were sent from WWE to come destroy WCW. They were two WWF guys coming over to the competition. Hogan, who had worked for, he was Mr. WWF for so long, joining forces with them. It was part of this perceived invasion that was going on at the time. There was no invasion in 1992 in WWF. If they turned Hogan heel, it would have just been Hogan going heel. He's sick of the fans. I still think it could have worked, but it wouldn't have been anything close to what the heel turn, you know, amounted to in WCW. That's what made that thing so big. That's what made the NWO so huge. Hogan goes heel in 92. I don't think there's an NWO in 96. And if there is, it doesn't have Hogan, and I don't think it works as well. It had to be Hogan. Wesley, I recently was down in New Orleans for Comic-Con, and to my surprise, Jim Duggan was there. My question is, why did he never win a world title in WWF or WCW? Well, by the time he got to WCW, I mean, he wasn't winning any world titles at that point. Okay, that just wasn't going to happen. In WWE, I know I talked about this on a podcast a couple of years ago. In his book, which I did not read, I read reviews of it, but in his book, Duggan blames the arrest with the Iron Sheik in 87 for derailing a possible title run. Now, would he have actually become world champion? Guys say that. Who the hell knows? Most of the time, I'm sure it's not true. But he really thinks he would have gotten a run with the world or the Intercontinental belt had that arrest never happened. And he says even after they brought him back, they never really pushed him or trusted him the same way again. And I argued at the time, and I'll argue the same thing again now, I argue that it really is not as far-fetched as you may think to think that Jim Duggan could have either had a run with the WWF title, or he could have chased as the top babyface for the championship in 88. Duggan was a big name in Mid-South, as was DiBiase, so the two of them had worked a whole bunch of times together. In WWF, once he came over, he had already been headlining some shows with Andre the Giant. He was headlining events with Andre. That was a big deal. So let's say, hypothetically, Honky Tonk Man, who has admitted that he just refused to do the job for Randy Savage when WWF wanted him to drop the Intercontinental title to Savage on that main event show in 88, he said, I'm not doing it. Let's say, hypothetically, that Honky Tonk Man does what he's told, and he drops the title to Randy Savage, and Randy Savage, instead of going to WrestleMania and winning the Winged Eagle, he wins the Intercontinental Championship for a second time. Hogan took time off to go film No Holds Barred, so Hogan is going to go away no matter what. You can't keep the title on Hogan because he's going to film a movie, so he disappears. Ted DiBiase, who originally had been earmarked to win that tournament, and DiBiase sure thinks so, let's say he actually wins. They have a tournament for the vacant title. Ted DiBiase becomes WWF champion. Okay, at WrestleMania 4. DiBiase and Duggan, again, they had that huge feud together in Mid-South. They worked together a whole bunch of times. I could see DiBiase as the champion with Duggan as the top babyface, chasing for the belt until Hogan comes back. Maybe not winning it, but chasing for it. It really is not a far-fetched idea. Duggan was over. And again, he got the arrest and the firing happened not long after he came over to WWF. So when people think of Jim Duggan, they think of, the guy with the tongue. Like, he looks ridiculous, right? How can you take this guy seriously as a top guy? He wasn't doing that in Mid-South. We don't know what he would have been doing. Maybe he would have been booked a little more seriously. You know, because he was very popular. And if Savage gets the IC and Hogan goes away, I mean, who's your next babyface? Right? Could have been Jim Duggan. It's not that far-fetched. Michael from Lusk, Wyoming. We'll do a couple more here. Are you surprised that WWE has never acknowledged the fact that Bobby the Brain Heenan is the only man to be on both debut episodes of Raw and Nitro? I actually did not realize that until I got your email. I think that's very cool. I think Bobby is the greatest. I am surprised it wasn't mentioned, I guess, in some way, maybe on like a Monday Night War DVD or something, but they don't really talk about Bobby much, which I think is a crime, and it's a shame. And so, in a way, I guess maybe I shouldn't be surprised. But Heenan is just the absolute best. And it's funny, I was watching some old stuff the other day on YouTube. He asked Gorilla Monsoon, he's like, do you know Coco Beware's mother? Do you know what her first name is? Tupper. And it's such a corny joke, and yet I still laugh my ass off. I used to laugh my ass off at a lot of one-liners that Jerry Lawler would do back in the 90s, too. And Heenan was the king of that. So I was laughing my ass off. It's a lot of fun to go back and watch the old banter between him and Monsoon and just watch the skits from Primetime and all that kind of stuff. Bobby was just the best. Juan from Puerto Rico, buy or sell on which Shawn Michaels' feet is more overrated, his left or his right? No, I'm just kidding. His Iron Man match with Bret Hart at WrestleMania 12 or him winning the Royal Rumble in 1995 entering at number one? Well, I mean, I never hear anybody rating that 95 Rumble match very highly. It was a cool finish. I love the finish, but the Rumble itself sucked. And it really isn't so impressive when you enter number one in a Rumble match that goes, I think it went like 38 minutes or something, because that was the one year where they actually had 1 minute intervals. Normally it's 2 minutes. Now I think these days it's like 90 seconds. It's 60 second intervals. And I think they actually marketed that Rumble as like the fastest paced Rumble ever or something. And yeah, it was like 38 minutes. It's like, ooh, he came in number one. Ooh, big deal. So, you know what though? I'm going to buy in the Iron Man match. I'm going to take your question as what is the most overrated, like, match of the two? Not necessarily, the most overrated feat. And I've said this before. I know it upsets some people. It wasn't a bad match, but people hold that thing up in such high regard. Oh, the Iron Man, the fabled Iron Man match between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 12, two of the best at the time, which they were, which makes it that much more disappointing that it wasn't a more exciting match than it was. I think that's a match that gets overrated a lot. It's not even the best Iron Man match. So I'm going to go with that one. And finally here, Brian from Wisconsin. Buy or sell? Shawn Michaels versus The Undertaker at WrestleMania 25 or Okada versus Kenny Omega from Wrestle Kingdom 11? Yeah, I knew this was coming. And you were not the only person to email that to me. And you guys are really trying to get me in trouble. And I didn't mention this earlier because I didn't want to get into trouble. But I'm going to buy on Shawn and Undertaker. Look, Okada Omega was an incredible match. I can't say enough good things about that match, okay? It was great. There's no doubt about it. I'm looking at it from the perspective of not just the match itself, but the story of the match, the story leading up to the match, just everything about it, the total package, the entrances, and Kenny Omega's entrance. Okada's entrance is awesome with the Okada dollars. I thought the Omega Terminator, you know, the T2, well, just the Terminator entrance was really cool. I saw people online like, who did it better, Kenny Omega or Triple H? Well, Triple H was more elaborate. I mean, he had these giant cyborgs rising from the stage. But Kenny Omega coming out with the half mask and the shotgun, I thought it was cool. But, you know, even WrestleMania, Shawn and The Undertaker, I loved what they did there, where Shawn kind of descended from the heavens, almost like an angel. And Undertaker, if you remember, he rose up from the stage, like the devil coming up from hell. Heaven and hell, that was the story they told. So just everything about that match, the streak being on the line, the drama that every near fall, every you know, 2.5 count, you were on the edge of your seat because you didn't want to see that streak end. Or maybe you did. Some people probably did want to see the streak end. But when I look at that match and I compare it to what we just saw with Omega and Okada, you've got two of the best matches you could possibly ever watch, but I'm still buying on Shawn and Undertaker. My mind has not changed, so I'm going to buy on that. All right, this week in Sound of History, this is, of course, episode 477 this week, but if we go in the Wayback Machine to episode 77, July 26, 2009... What was I talking about on that show? Well, I was talking about the infamous Jenna Maraska-Charmel match from TNA Victory Road. And let me tell you something. If Okada and Omega had a 6-star match, this match gets negative 6 stars. That's how bad it was. I don't think I will ever forget those slaps. The Jenna Maraska slaps that she gave to Charmel. What an absolute atrocity and just an embarrassment that match was. Episode 177, September 4, 2011. I talked about the SmackDown star who I thought deserved to have a run with the World Heavyweight title. That was part of the description I gave for the show. Who was that man? Well, that man was Mark Henry. I thought that WWE should give Mark Henry a win over Randy Orton at Night of Champions and let him have a run for the first time with the world title. And that's exactly what they ended up doing. And it was the best run of Henry's career. Also on that episode, I talked about Kurt Angle throwing a hissy fit on Twitter after learning that he placed number 34 in a WWE.com list of the top 50 superstars of all time. Boy, did Kurt have a meltdown. And then he quickly realized, I think, how stupid he sounded, and he apologized for it, and it was all water under the bridge. But I remember that meltdown that he had. Episode 277, June 9, 2013. I talked about Todd Kennelly being dropped from the Impact Announce team. Remember him? Todd Kennelly? I actually remember enjoying his work. I know he still does some announcing for pro wrestling on the indies. Also talked about Quentin Rampage Jackson and his face-off with Kurt Angle on Impact. Boy, did that go nowhere. I made a passionate argument for why WWE bringing The Rock in for publicity is different than Vince Russo booking David Arquette to be WCW champion. And one other discussion point from that show, what will Hulk Hogan's legacy be when he is gone? Mind you, this was before the sex tape leaked. I suspect my answer to that question, if you ask me today, would be different. And episode 377 from March 30th, 2015, I address Chris Jericho's criticism of the fans in the Hall of Fame and why he was right. I still think they ought to just cut the fans out of it and make it more intimate, but then I guess they can't sell 15,000 tickets if they do that. AJ Lee's retirement I talked about and where she falls in the history of top female performers. Daniel Bryan pitched a match around this time against Shinsuke Nakamura that he said we could air this on the WWE Network. And just looking back at that, it makes me so sad now. And also on this show, I talked about how to debut Charlotte or Sasha Banks on the Raw roster. That was almost 2 years ago that I pitched that. You can head over to the archives on thesolomonster.com and listen to that if you are interested, although the archives on Podbean only date back as far as episode 85. So if you cannot find those earlier shows, that would be why. I do have the first 10 sound offs I ever did uploaded to our YouTube channel. If you ever want to go back and check those out, they are there. So you can go to YouTube and subscribe. Next weekend is WWE's UK tournament. It's a 2-day tournament, January 14th and 15th from Blackpool, England at the Empress Ballroom. Apparently it is airing live, which would be 8 p.m. UK time, which I believe is 3 p.m., I think. 2 p.m. or 3 p.m. Eastern time here stateside. Next Saturday, I'm just telling you right now, next Saturday is going to be a bad day for me. I got a million things going on that day, and I am recording next weekend's podcast on Sunday before day two of the tournament even takes place, because I record the sound off, you know, usually mid to late morning. By early afternoon, I'm wrapping up. So there's a good chance I'm not going to be able to cover the tournament on next week's show. In fact, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be covering the tournament on next week's show. If not, I will try to come up with another solution. I believe I have a day off. That might be a 3-day weekend for me for Martin Luther King Day. We'll see. So we'll see if I can maybe do something after the fact. But any like UK fans or people who were hoping I would talk about the tournament next weekend, it's probably not happening. So just be aware of that. Don't forget to vote for the sound of voting. Officially voting now is underway. WrestlingRadioAwards.com. We are up for 4 different awards, including Show of the Year. You can just vote using the free ballot. Go to that page, scroll down, and you'll see it. So please vote for the sound of. Get your friends to vote. You can vote once a day in each category. Every single day until June, not June, no, you cannot vote until June. January 19th is the deadline. That is not this Thursday coming up, but the following Thursday. Each of my interviews with Bob Holly, Katrina, and DDP are also up for awards. So I thank everybody who helped nominate us. And now you can go ahead and vote. And we'll see how that turns out. Follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. I will be back next weekend. Somehow, I've got so much stuff going on. But next weekend will be episode 478 of the podcast as we roll on here in 2017. I want to thank everybody for their support. I want to thank everybody for all of the kind words. I've gotten a lot of nice letters in my inbox from people. Just random nice letters, hearing from people all over the world. It's very cool. You could leave love, by the way, for the podcast in iTunes and on Stitcher. We are a 5-star rated podcast. And I would very much appreciate that if you were to leave a review. So, until next weekend, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a fantastic week, and I will see you right back here next weekend, as always, for a brand new episode of The Sound Off. The Sound Off never sleeps. Remember that. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Sala Monster sounds off. What?
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the Big Show of TV shows. It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Monster Sounds Off. Since 2007, The Sala Monster Sounds Off. Available at thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Sala Monster Sound Off.